discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
A beautiful autumn day in store for us today. Sunny skies with highs in the mid-60s. Light winds from the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 45 degrees in Atchison, 44 in Lawrence, 43 in Topeka. This is KPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Biden has apologized for the government's role in running boarding schools for Native American children, calling it yesterday a blot on American history. For decades, thousands of Native children at those schools endured abuse, family separation, neglect, and the erasure of their tribal identities. Member station KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
On the outskirts of Phoenix, at the Gila River Indian Reservation, President Biden tried to make amends for the U.S.'s 150-year campaign to forcibly assimilate indigenous children.
I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize. That's long overdue.
Overdue by more than half a century, the federal Indian boarding school era began in 1819 and didn't end until 1969, a year before Biden held public office for the first time.
I believe it's important that we do know. You know, generations of Native children stolen, taken away to places they didn't know, with people they never met, who spoke a language they had never heard.
Biden noted that children were routinely punished, sometimes beaten, just for speaking their language, wearing tribal clothing, or growing their hair long. The Interior Department has documented nearly 1,000 confirmed deaths across more than 500 Native boarding schools nationwide.
It's horribly, horribly wrong. It's a sin on our soul. I'd like to ask, with your permission, for a moment of silence, as you remember those lost and the generations living with that trauma.
What the president called an attempt to right a wrong resonated with the crowd, filled with tribal leaders.
I think we can say with no exaggeration that President Biden truly is Indian country's president.
That's Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis of the Gila River Indian community. He thanked Biden for what he called his compassionate leadership.
And with the president's words today and his actions before and since, we can begin the healing.
That healing starts with Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. She's the first Native American cabinet member. For the last 4 years, she has led the very same agency responsible for generations of harm.
But as we stand here together, my friends and relatives, we know that the federal government failed. It failed to annihilate our languages, our traditions, our lifeways. It failed to destroy us because we persevered.
Biden's first diplomatic trip to Indian country comes just 10 days before Election Day and the swing state Arizona, where the Native vote is front and center.
I pictured my grandmother getting her hair cut and just being really emotional.
Sandra Miller's from the Fonoaufem Nation and with the Arizona Democratic Party. She says this apology is already resonating with indigenous voters.
He still sees us and he still wants us to heal, even as he's saying his farewell.
A chorus of Thank You, Joe chants rang out as Ofem tribal performers sang and danced Biden off stage. For NPR News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio on the Gila River Indian Reservation.
There was a massive rally in Georgia this week for Vice President Kamala Harris. Speaking to more than 20,000 people, she had a message for the young progressive wing of the party.
I've seen what you do, and I see how you are doing it, because you are rightly impatient for change.
Democrats just barely won Georgia 4 years ago, thanks in part to organizing on the left. And as NPR White House correspondent Ozma Khalid reports from Atlanta, they're hoping for a repeat.
Hey, guys. How are y'all being?
The other day, I met up with a group of organizers and progressive activists at Manuel's Tavern. It's a political hotspot that's been visited by a lot of Democratic politicians over the years. I first met these folks back in May, and at that point, they were really uneasy about Joe Biden's re-election bid. So much has changed since then, so I wanted to hear how they're feeling about the election now.
With Harris as the candidate that we get to choose from now, it does feel a little bit easier.
That's Adrian Consinor. In the spring, he told me he did not feel comfortable voting for Biden, mainly because of Gaza. He's still upset by the images he sees on social media, but he feels more optimistic for change with Harris.
I wanted the Democratic Party to earn my vote.
Do you think they've done that?
At this current juncture, they're doing a way better job than what they were.
So all of you all agree it was better. It was better for the Democratic Party to replace the top of the ticket.
No brainer.
Some say they feel like Harris might be more willing to listen to different, younger perspectives. But they're also wary about her overtures to Republicans and her tough talk on the border, plus her continued unconditional support for Israel as it wages war in Gaza and now Lebanon. Wani Shin says in her view, Harris is better than Biden, but still she feels lukewarm about her.
It's not like I'm so gung-ho and I don't even have a sign in front of the house because I just don't want to. I'm not super excited, but it's better than Trump.
Shin works with the Asian American community. She says this cycle, she can't get herself to go door knocking for Harris.
If I'm having a hard time, how can I convince others to do so? It just seems very disingenuous.
What is striking is that everybody here, despite their previous reservations, they've all come home to the Democratic Party. They're worried about a second Donald Trump presidency. Here's Marissa Pyle's calculation.
The reality is one of these two people is going to be president, and I would like the one that is not going to do fascism.
Harris is campaigning hard on warnings from former Trump advisors that the Republican nominee is a danger to democracy. Pyle says she had a really hard time voting for Harris, but ultimately she sees her vote as, quote, harm mitigation.
There wasn't really anything she said that did it for me. It's the threat to everyone else. And I, as a white person, have a lot of privilege in society, and I don't feel like it is right for me to decide to stand back and allow other people to get hurt.
Sitting next to her, Brian Ramirez says he doesn't love how the vice president talks about immigration. He used to be undocumented.
When she speaks on the border, she speaks a lot on drugs, crime, that kind of thing. When it's much more than that.
He's also put off by Harris's efforts to persuade Republican moderates.
It just hurts when she says, oh, I'll have Republicans in my cabinet, or she's campaigning with Liz Cheney.
Harris has been visiting suburban communities with the former congresswoman, a Republican. Despite his qualms, Ramirez, who works with the Georgia Youth Justice Coalition, is still voting for Harris and canvassing for her. Sitting with us was Reverend Gerald Durley. He's a well-known civil rights leader around here.
This is what I say to young people. This is a T-shirt I wear. And all over where I speak, if I can, you can.
Those are the words on the black T-shirt he's got on. He got it custom made.
If I can vote for 65 years, you can vote for 15 more days. If I can stay in the movement for 65 years, you can make. I said, if I can, you can. If I can, you can.
It's a message he's delivering across the state, trying to convince voters to show up for Harris, making the point the change takes time. Asma Khalid, NPR News, Atlanta.
The documentary film Dahomey is a story of return, the restitution of stolen royal treasures. 26 artifacts were among thousands taken by French colonial troops in the late 19th century from the Kingdom of Dahomey, which is now the Republic of Benin in West Africa. The loot was displayed in Paris, but in 2021 the artifacts were carefully loaded into crates and flown back home, a journey that the French-Senegalese film director Mati Diop captures in her new documentary. The film won the coveted Golden Bear Prize earlier this year at the Berlin Film Festival. And Matty Diop joins us now from our studios at NPR West. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I have read that you felt it was your duty to make this film. How so?
Yeah, in duty, I don't want to make it sound too heavy either, because it was the most fantastic challenge and journey and experience as a filmmaker. But I felt that it was very important to document this historical moment. Most of the archives from Africa have been filmed by colonizers. And so I think it's very important for us to take in charge through cinema or stories. And so this is what I meant by duty.
This is a documentary, but there are some dramatized moments. And for example, you gave voice to one of the statues. We all bear the same scars, it says, uprooted, ripped out. The spoils of massive plundering. Why did you want to give voice that way to the statues, and how did you infer what they would say?
For me, the most important gesture with doing this film was to give back a story, a voice, a language, a power, a subjectivity to these artifacts that have been dispossessed by their own story. So the first gesture was to make sure these artifacts stopped being objectified and could again become subjects with agency, with point of views, with subjectivity. This is also why they've been filmed from the first sequence at Museum of Quai Branly before their departure. They've been filmed in a way that the audience can experience the journey of return from the perspectives of the artifacts.
Large part of your film focuses on students in Benin.
Yes.
Talking about the significance, as they see it, of the return of the royal artifacts, what surprised you most about the back and forth of the students?
What surprised me most has more to do with something very specific about the Beninese culture I discovered there, which was the huge quality of listening within the debates. It was not only people talking to each other, imposing their point of view. So much about that debate is about listening to what the other has to say, which is probably one of the reasons why this debate is so rich and so complex.
Yeah. I wonder how you feel. It is heartbreaking when you take a look at the film and after a while realize that, you know, in all those file drawers and boxes just stored away with nobody seeing it is artwork from De Helme. But what about the argument I've heard from some museum professionals in places like London, Paris, New York over the years, that at least that kept the artwork intact?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say the contrary, but I don't think it's the question. I think to say this is just a way to erase a debate which is social, which is political, and the level of denial on the colonial legacy and responsibility really needs to become a subject in France. They have too much to lose by deconstruct this politic.
Let me ask you this finally. Should European institutions, museums, colleges return all the art that was plundered from colonial times? Or is there something to be said for people in Paris being able to see art from Benin?
To me, it's a question that is not a good question. It's exactly the same nature of statesmen then, at least they were saved, at least they are intact. And to ask, should they all be returned, to me is a little bit, there's something a bit perverse about it, because how many artifacts have been returned? We're talking about 26, when we know that more than a million of African artifacts have been stolen, have been captured. So to say, should we give them all back, to me, is kind of a provocation. Because it's such a despite for the people who have been dispossessed by these artifacts.
Mati Diop is director of the new film, Dahomey. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In the coming years, the U.S. is expected to be increasingly crisscrossed by pipelines carrying carbon dioxide, which advocates say could play a big role in controlling harmful emissions. South Dakota offers a look at the possible backlash to those pipelines as a new pipeline law could be repealed by voters next month. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports.
Aaron Johnson's 1994 International Harvester tractor digs up the soil behind it.
And so now we're chisel pawing.
There's already an oil pipeline under Johnson's certified organic field in rural Lake County, South Dakota. Now, a carbon dioxide sequestration company, Summit Carbon Solutions, wants to run a pipeline that he worries could leak and destroy his organic field or even harm his family. He notes that one ruptured a few years ago in Mississippi, hospitalizing people.
I want to be able to do what I want to do on my side of the fence. You do what you want to do on your side of the fence, and let's keep it that way. Good fences do make good neighbors, and a proposed pipeline crosses any and all fences.
At 2,500 miles long, the pipeline would carry liquefied carbon dioxide from 57 ethanol plants across the Midwest to North Dakota for underground storage. It's a possible way of reducing emissions that lead to climate change and can help win federal tax credits. But the state's utility regulator denied permits for the project based on county ordinances. Then, the state legislature wrote a new law requiring counties to prove their pipeline ordinances are reasonable. Critics say it weakens local control and property rights. It was unpopular enough that several lawmakers who voted for it lost in the primaries. And activists got a proposal on the ballot to repeal the law.
It's deceitful legislation. It's a sellout to corporate America.
Jim Eschenbaum is leading the effort to overturn the law. He's a retired farmer and county commissioner in Hand County. He says companies really want carbon dioxide pipelines because they can be helpful in fracking, which he doesn't oppose but says companies should acknowledge. But some defend the law.
In any good legislation, nobody's particularly happy with how things turn out.
That's Republican State Representative Roger Chase. He says the law lets counties charge companies fees that can lower property taxes. It also holds pipeline companies liable for damages and requires them to release information about ruptures. Chase says if voters repeal the law, called Referred Law 21, it'll actually benefit pipeline companies.
Because they're still going to have the ability to get permitted. And if they do get permitted and we repeal Senate Bill 201 or Referred Law 21, then all of that goes away.
Summit Carbon Solutions says it supports the law, as do several groups representing corn growers. Corn's used in making ethanol.
There are multiple tensions going on here.
That's Martin Lockman, a climate law fellow with New York's Columbia Law School. He says the pipeline debate in South Dakota is a preview of a national debate for the next 25 years. There are already thousands of miles of these pipelines. Many times more are expected. He says communities are skeptical. They don't see how they benefit and worry about the risks. And there are other issues, like their effectiveness against climate change.
And all of these can't be taken individually. People who are deciding how to vote on this issue will have to grapple with all of these.
Regardless of the vote on Election Day, Summit Carbon Solutions officials say they intend to reapply for pipeline permits in South Dakota. For NPR News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Lake County, South Dakota.
This is NPR News.
North Carolina is seen by many as a must-win state for Donald Trump. A key part of his constituency there, conservative Christians.
You can have some people with some pretty deep moral struggles who are upholding a platform that we support.
One North Carolina religious leader on why Trump's support from conservative Christians runs so deep. That's on All Things Considered.
Join us for All Things Considered. from 4 to 5 o'clock this afternoon on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment, inviting listeners to the Dia de los Muertos Festival on November 1st, featuring the Celebration of Souls exhibit on loan from the Chicago Field Museum. Details at explorenoto.org.
Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, at last night's World Series, a fond farewell to the one of the most beloved pitchers of the LA Dodgers. We'll have that story just ahead on Weekend Edition Saturday here on Kansas Public Radio. A beautiful autumn day in store for us today. Sunny skies, highs in the mid-60s. Light winds from the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly clear overnight. Lows around 40 degrees. Sunny and warmer for tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center, presenting Mariachi Arencia de Mexico on October 26th. The new generation of mariachi takes the stage for a night of Mexican music. More at jccc.edu/mtc.
Everyone can leave a gift to KPR through their will. It's an inspired way to support an organization that enriches your life and that of others in your community. Find out how you can leave your legacy gift to KPR at legacy.kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's been called one of the 20th century's most staggering ecological disasters. The Aral Sea was once one of the world's largest lakes, but over the course of nearly half a century, this giant body of water has virtually evaporated into the desert. Straddling the borders of the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, its waters were a lifeline for Central Asia. NPR's Above the Fray fellow Valerie Kipnis takes us now to the shrinking backs of the Aral Sea.
Sometimes, all you can hear is the wind in the once busy port town of Moynak, which now stands at the edge of what is now desert. Here, six massive rusted ships lie on their bellies like beached fish on the sand.
So, here we are in the cemetery, the graveyard of ships, it's called.
Nearby are abandoned fish processing plants and canning factories. Gusts of wind send dust sweeping through the city, making townspeople cough. But Moynak wasn't always so quiet. It was once a flourishing city, home to about 40,000 people, sitting on the shore of the Aral Sea. A Soviet-era documentary from the 60s boasts of the sea's vastness and its role in local industries. Октябрь Даспанов was born into a family of fishermen in Moynak.
We would play around this port, hang out on the boats, and life here, it felt like it never stopped.
That Moynak lives only in memory. Decades ago, Soviet officials diverted water from the Amudarya River, a vital lifeline for the Aral Sea, to grow cotton in the desert. This decision had consequences you could see from space. A shrinking sea.
People would wake up and there would be this massive dunes covering the windows and doors.
The water became unsafe to drink. It was hard to breathe.
People would sweep, but the next day the sand and dust would just come again.
The Aral Kum, the youngest desert in the world, formed on the shriveling shores of the Aral. These days, Despanov works in the region's capital, Nukus. For centuries, it was an important settlement on the banks of what was once the wide Amudarya, a stop along the Silk Road. But in Uzbekistan, the Soviet legacy still has a strong grip over the region. And this time, what's at stake is the region's last remaining lifeline, the Amudarya. With every year, the water levels of the Amudarya drop, mostly because of overuse, mismanagement, and climate change. 3 decades after the fall of the Soviet Union, Uzbekistan still directs 90% of its water to agriculture. Khalif, who has to only go by his first name for fear of government retaliation, is among the many farmers in this region grappling with severe water shortages. These days, he grows cotton because he says the government requires him to do so on this land.
I have a contract with the state. 35 hectares is cotton, 10 hectares is wheat. If I don't have this contract, I wouldn't get water.
Contracts like Khalif's are common. Farmers in Uzbekistan don't own their land. They lease it from the government. Government officials told me that farmers are free to grow what they want. But the farmers we spoke to said they're pressured to sign contracts with private companies on what to plant and for how much to sell it for, meaning farmers have little choice over what they grow. Plus, getting a decent yield of the crop gets harder with every year.
The summers are really hot. The rains that we're supposed to get on time, they're either early or too late. Overall, the climate has changed and it's affecting us.
Uzbekistan knows it has a problem. President Shavkat Mirziyoyev has declared 2024 the start of a, quote, emergency regime of water conservation.
Is it good? It's good. But the question to them is, so many years already we have this problem.
For people like Yusup Kamalov, it's a step in the right direction, but it's just too little, too late.
Why it still not happened? The answer is no democracy, no freedom, at least for farmers.
Kamalov is an engineer and an environmental activist who's been trying to figure out how to solve Uzbekistan's water problem since the 90s. The contradiction is striking. The government promotes conservation while propping up a system that encourages overconsumption of water. It raises a troubling question. Is the Uzbek government truly committed to change? Kamalov and I decided to see for ourselves. As we drove through cotton fields back towards the former port town of Moynak, we passed unlined canals siphoning water from the already depleted Amudarya River. Kamalov shakes his head.
Because the farmers still works as a slaves for government, not as a free businessman or free entrepreneur.
For Kamalov, the problem and solution are simple. Uzbekistan is still stuck in the ways of a planned economy, and as long as that doesn't change, nothing else will either.
That is why for farmers it is useless to tell them safe water, because they don't have any incentives or stimulus to save water.
When we get to the port of Moynak, Yusup Kamalov looks out into the cemetery of ships, an eerie reminder of what once was and a scary premonition for what might happen if things don't change.
We are still by mines in the past. We're still in the Soviet life, by Soviet agriculture, Soviet economics, Soviet management. That is why it is a biggest problem to open your eyes for the future.
And the future in Uzbekistan is one that's coming way too fast. For NPR News, this is Valerie Kipnis reporting from Nukus, Karakol, Pakistan.
In the walk, a child and her grandmother put on their jackets and hats and leave their house.
My granny is taking me on the walk because leaders are not born, she says. They're made through molding and modeling. What's the walk? I ask. You'll see. And there's a few treasured souls coming too.
The pair stops at home stores, even the barber shop, to pick up friends and neighbors. The procession grows and grows as the group heads to the polls. Time to vote.
A wave of men stroll outside. They're prepared and waiting. Ready? Granny asks. Yes, ma'am. You know, I thought after 2008, I could skip a few of these walks, but I see we need them more than ever. You right about that, Granny says. And we walk on.
The Walk is a 2023 book by Winsome Bingham and E.B. Lewis. For our series Picture This, they stop by to talk about why a children's book about voting is more important than ever.
The message is clear. We're stronger together. That's the message. I grew up in a community that was about sharing and caring, where if you did something, you get a whipping up the street. And by the time you get home, you still get a whipping, right?
Same neighborhood.
I grew up where that neighborhood went to the polls together to vote. School is out, all the kids in the street. As a kid, I told you this before, I did not realize how important and central that was to my life.
My experience was just the opposite. My parents went and it was a secret almost. And as a result, it took me into my late 20s before I became a voter, you know? So that's the importance of this book, getting kids to understand what that democracy looks like.
Looks like, yeah. Because we think about voting and we individualize it so much, but at the end of the day, one person doesn't elect mayor or a school board member or city council or the president. We need a collective community to make that happen, to make that work.
That civil duty and having those conversations. But that's what picture books are about, really.
Yes.
And that's what this book does. Well, my house, at Thanksgiving, the kids were down in the basement, and then you had to be able to reach a certain age to get upstairs at the big people table, the grown folk table. And so this is their opportunity for kids to get to the grown folk table, you know, to get to see what they're doing.
So let's bring your illustrated storytelling. So tell them, because I love the couple of those are my favorite spreads. So go.
It's your one of your favorites, the one that you own now, is the one where the church is in the background. For me, as an illustrator, if you look at any of my books, you'll see what I bring to the table is that I bring emotion.
Facts.
I love the images of the gathering, that line of individuals as it starts to build, young and old. My process of making books is to come up with the thumbnails. And then I travel. So if the book takes place in a particular country, experience like that, I will go to the country. In this book, The Walk, I went to Huntsville, Alabama. This little town got together this procession for me. The cops actually stopped traffic for the procession. And I am filming and photographing this procession in each scene along the way in my thumbnails. All those scenes that you see in the book are real. We went to a barbershop and got all the people in the barbershop at that particular time. They actually were part of the book. And what I did to pay them, everybody got a free haircut on me. So it was fun.
You do an amazing job, EB. That book, when I saw it, I was in awe. One of the things I don't do, I do not critique the illustrators. I'm like, that's EB Lewis. You think I can tell him what to do? Like, seriously, you're a professional. You know how to do it. You did an amazing job.
My idea in writing, because I am writing with pictures, is that I know what images is going to pull the heartstrings. If you flip through a book fast, nothing made you linger. And a great book makes you linger. It's like a great meal.
The oxtail, yeah.
You know, that thing just savors in that mouth. You just savor that flavor. And after the meal, I wanted it to linger in my mouth. Yes. I don't want to wash it down, you know. Let me just walk around with this great flavor in my mouth. That's what a good book should do.
I agree. It should definitely feed your soul. And it's for you to connect, for you to find that one thing. Someone came to me. I was at an event. She says, what's so special about this book is because it's about a community and you're not telling who to vote for. You didn't leave anyone out. You just said the people went, you saw red signs and blue signs. And she says, that's what makes it what it is. It's speaking to everyone.
There's no preaching in this. You know, it's a slice of life. You know, it happens to be centered around voting, you know, what it means to become an adult in a democracy.
Yes.
We assume that children learn from the things that come out of our mouths. And that's just simply not true. They learn from our behaviors.
To me, the most important part is when the little girl asks her, Granny, why do we vote? She says, we vote for hope. And because leaders are not born, they're made through molding and modeling. My great-grandmother always said that. She's never the one to say, do what I say. She always says, do as I do. And that is so profound to me, because if we're modeling, right, what we want to see, they're going to pick up on that. And if you haven't been building memories with your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, the kids in your neighborhood, this is a time you can start off with this book, talking about family and community and change and hope and progress. This is where you start the walk.
Author Winsome Bingham and illustrator E.B. Lewis talking about their children's book, The Walk. For more conversations between authors and illustrators, you can check out npr.org/picturethis. Our series is produced by Samantha Balaban. First game of one of the most anticipated World Series in memory had an ending for the history books last night, a grand slam to win the game for the Dodgers over the vaunted Yankees, and a fitting tribute to one of the most beloved L.A. Dodger players of all time, Fernando Valenzuela. Here's Steve Futterman from Dodger Stadium.
In a city where surprise endings have been written into scripts for decades, the L.A. Dodgers came up with one of their own last night. L.A. was trailing the New York Yankees 3-2 and down to its last out when this happened.
Cortez delivers. Freeman hits the ball to right field. She is gone!
The call by Joe Davis on Fox Sports, and just like that, the Dodgers won the series opener. A walk-off grand slam home run by LA's Freddie Freeman, the first time that has happened in World Series history. Dodger Stadium erupted in celebration. The song I Love LA was played over the stadium speakers. Fans like Jorge Meza could not believe what they just saw.
Oh my God, it's the most incredible sports moment in my life. Oh yes! I'm so happy right now. Oh my gosh.
For the hero of the night, Freddie Freeman, it was just like a childhood fantasy come true.
Those are the kind of things when you're 5 years old with your two older brothers and you're playing football in the backyard, and those are the scenarios you kind of dream about.
But before the game, fans remember dreams of the past.
Joining us tonight are members of the Valenzuela family.
The Dodgers saluted their iconic pitcher from the 1980s and 90s, Fernando Valenzuela, who died on Tuesday at the age of 63.
At this time, please join us for a moment of silence.
Many at last night's game remembered growing up watching and experiencing what became known, especially to Latino fans, as Fernando Mania.
It's a moment in time that can never be brought back. And so for us Latinos who were able to experience that, once a lifetime experience.
Jerry Macias recalled as a child seeing games on TV with his father.
He was what I needed for me and my father to become a unit. My father taught me the sport of baseball. And so because of Fernando and the steps he took to bring my parents together and me sitting on my parents' couch watching the game, I'll always share those memories.
Friday was a night that connected memories of the past with some brand new memories. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me.
Just a great time. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $60 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of more than 504,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR in Atchison 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan at 99.5. Coming up next here on Kansas Public Radio, it's NPR's News Quiz. Wait, wait, don't tell me.
Support for KPR comes from New, presenting Zoo Lights, and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org.
Sunny skies today, highs in the mid-60s. It's 45 degrees in Topeka, 46 here in Lawrence. This is KPR.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Dulce Sloan, filling in for Peter Sable. It's a weird Halloween week. Every time you say trick-or-treat, people think you're asking who they're voting for. And speaking of the election, we'll share the latest news in air travel for those who are planning on fleeing the country. Plus, sports icons Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe go for the gold in our game, and Bill Curtis renegotiates his contract.
Would you like 3 more months at half price?
We'll ask who's really changing their terms on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Israel carried out airstrikes against Iran overnight, targeting Iran's air defenses and the storage and production sites of ballistic missiles and drones. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv. This was after Iran had conducted missile strikes against Israel earlier this month.
Israel's response was designed as a kind of a quid pro quo after Iran carried out its missile strikes on Israel on October 1st, and also designed in a way that Iran would be able to contain any reaction. Israel says that its retaliation against Iran is now over, and Iran indeed is signaling that it's downplaying this.
NPR's Daniel Estrin. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer urged Iran not to respond. Villa Marx has more.
At a press conference in Samoa, at the end of a Commonwealth Heads of State meeting, Starmer echoed his previous stance, saying he'd been, quote, clear that Israel has the right to defend itself against Iranian aggression. But he insisted the warring parties needed to, quote, avoid further regional escalation, and he said he urged all sides to show restraint. He said Britain would work with its allies to help with that de-escalation and said that Iran should not retaliate to these latest strikes. Early UK analysis indicated that Israel had heeded advice from the British and United States to avoid targeting energy, nuclear or leadership sites in Iran. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks in London.
With 10 days until Election Day in the U.S., both major presidential candidates are in Michigan, where early voting is now underway statewide. It began in Detroit last week. Democrat Kamala Harris is campaigning in Kalamazoo, joined by former First Lady Michelle Obama. Republican Donald Trump is holding a rally in suburban Detroit. The candidates will move next to Pennsylvania, where there are 19 electoral votes at stake. Across the country, it's estimated that more than 38 million people have already cast ballots, either in person or by mail. U.S. officials say Russia manufactured a fake video that purports to show someone destroying ballots marked for Trump in Pennsylvania. NPR's Shannon Bond reports Russian propagandists have made other phony videos targeting the Democratic ticket.
Federal intelligence officials and the FBI say Russia is behind the video, which has spread widely on social media, including Elon Musk's X. The video was quickly debunked by local election officials and the district attorney's office in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. They say the envelopes and ballots shown are not what the county uses to vote. Federal officials say the fake video is part of Russia's efforts to undermine confidence in the integrity of the election and stoke division among Americans. The video was posted by an X account that previously shared another video making false accusations against Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz. Intelligence officials have said that was also a Russian fake. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
This is NPR News. In the northeastern Philippines, rescue crews are scrambling to reach thousands of people stranded after a tropical storm swept the region yesterday. Officials say at least 65 people are confirmed dead in landslides and flooding. Although the storm moved away yesterday, state weather forecasters say it could make a U-turn and come back next week. A retrial began this week for former Louisville police officer Brett Hankison over his role in the police raid that killed 26-year-old Breonna Taylor in her apartment in March 2020. Louisville Public Media's Giselle Roden has more.
Federal prosecutors allege Hankinson blindly fired 10 shots through a covered window and a sliding glass door from outside Taylor's apartment. Prosecutors argued Hankinson's actions are against police protocol and endangered people around him. Hankinson's shots didn't strike Taylor, but they went into a neighboring apartment where a pregnant woman, her boyfriend, and her 5-year-old son were sleeping. Hankinson was charged with 2 felony counts of violating the civil rights of Taylor, her boyfriend, and the neighboring family. The trial is expected to continue through Tuesday. Last year, a judge declared a mistrial after the jury couldn't reach a unanimous decision. If convicted this time, Hankinson could face a maximum of life in prison. For NPR News, I'm Giselle Roden in Louisville.
In the opening game of the World Series, the Los Angeles Dodgers beat the New York Yankees 6-3 in Los Angeles last night. It ended with the first game-ending grand slam in World Series history by Freddie Freeman in the 10th inning. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Sunny skies today, highs in the mid-60s, should be a beautiful Saturday. Warmer tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s. It's 49 degrees in Emporia, 48 here in Lawrence, 47 in Topeka.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. Get out your diaper cream, and the voice as smooth as a baby's butt. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater at the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal, Dulce Sloan.
It's me! Hey! Thank you! Thank you, Bill, and thanks, everybody. We have a great show for you today. Now, I know some of y'all are wondering, how did she get this job filling in for Peter Sagal? I mean, well, who knew that a man who runs so much couldn't beat me in a leg wrestling match? Later on, we'll be talking to sports power couple Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe about their new podcast, A Touch More. But first, it's your turn to touch us more. I'm single. By giving us a call, the number is 888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 888-924-8924. Now let's welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, my name is Katie Peel, and I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
Now, what do you do in this here Denver, Colorado, up there in the mountains where you can't breathe?
Well, I am a recently resigned public school teacher, and I manage a small coffee shop and a farm-to-table restaurant.
Ooh, okay.
That's very Colorado.
Very NPR. Well, Katie, hey, girl, hey! Let me introduce you to our panel. First is a comedian performing soon in Sunnyvale, California, and Erie, PA, and host of the trivia podcast, Go Fact Yourself, airing now on LAS Public Radio. It's Helen Hahn!
Hello! Hi, Katie!
Next, the comedian will be part of Kyle Kinane's Kinanesgiving show on November 27th at the Talia Hall in Chicago. It's Adam Burt.
Hello, Katie.
And the comedian will be at Helium Comedy Club in Philadelphia November 9th through the 11th. It's Alonzo Bodie.
Hello, Katie.
Well,
Hey, girl, welcome to the show, Katie. Now, you're going to play Who's Bill this time. Bill Curtis is going to read you three quotes from this week's news. If you can correctly identify or explain two of them, you'll win our prize, any voice from our show you choose on your voicemail. You ready?
Yep.
Okay. Here's your first quote.
All the single ladies, all the single ladies, all the single ladies, all the single ladies.
That was somebody adding her name to the many celebrities endorsing Kamala Harris this week. Who was it?
Beyonce?
Beyonce! With less than 2 weeks till Election Day, the celebrity endorsements are rolling in. Harris has now wrapped up Beyonce, Eminem, Taylor Swift, and Bruce Springsteen, while Trump has earned the endorsements of Joe Exotic from Tiger King and a bunch of people on Jeffrey Epstein's flight dossier. And it's not officially an endorsement. You know, Beyonce just appeared at a Kamala Harris rally in Houston yesterday. You know, it was a move that you know, she said, I support Kamala, but not enough to fly to Pennsylvania. And that is my Beyonce impression.
I love that, because they keep saying, oh, it's unofficial. It's unofficial. Like, really? Really, Beyonce is unofficially endorsing Kamala? Come on, I think we're a little bit past coy.
What if she was a big RFK person? What if Beyonce was like, I don't know, there's just something about him.
That's the question. Where's the surprise? Is anyone surprised that Beyonce is supporting Kamala Harris? Only people who surprise are the people who still claim to be undecided. Right, those geniuses who are like, oh, well, if Beyonce's involved, maybe I can make a decision. I mean, what other endorsement? Who else could there be?
Well, we did have a very, according to my notes, this week we also got the October surprise, the endorsement that could change the race. Now, Kamala Harris, this is true, got the endorsement of, wait for it, the Insane Clown Posse. Because, like, you know, things are getting crazy when Shaggy Two Dope is out here calling for a saner clown posse.
All right, Dulce, you backed me into a corner. I, Alonzo Bowden, now officially endorse Kamala Harris.
Thank you!
I'm in.
Alonzo!
I'm in.
I'm shocked.
I'm in.
I was at the edge of my seat the entire time.
I know, brother. Who knew? You can relax.
I didn't even know you were a juggalo, but... Didn't Trump got a huge endorsement this week? Trump was endorsed by E. coli.
Yeah. He was pretending to work at that McDonald's.
Yeah, and 5 days after he worked at McDonald's, E. coli was like, well, if you let him in, you kind of let us in.
All right, Katie, here's our next quote.
Are you sure? Would you like 3 more months at half price?
Those are questions we may never see again, thanks to a new federal ruling making it easier to do what?
I'm not sure. Could I have a hint?
Okay, I can give you a hint. Like, say you want to stop the gym. Like, you know how Planet Fitness will con you into thinking you're going to come back? This new law will make it easier for you to not have to eat donuts in a gym.
Gym membership?
You know what, Katie? You were close enough. It's cancel subscription. The new law is called Click to Cancel. It requires that you be able to cancel a subscription the same way you signed up for it, right? This is the kind of news that is going to have million Americans going, wait, I subscribed to Peacock?
So this works. So this allows you to cancel the same way you signed up. So do I have to be drunk?
I think that's between you and your God. I don't think, because, like, under the rule, like, if you sign up with one click, you have to be able to cancel with one click. So, you know, you just look for, like, a little button on the screen that's like a little puppy that says, but if you cancel, I'll stop.
Now, do you have to subscribe to Click to Cancel in order to click to cancel? That's going to be the next thing. Are you subscribed to Click to Cancel? No, well, then you can't click to cancel.
I don't know if we've hit that rabbit hole yet.
Can they just have a button to tell Duolingo just to calm the hell down? Like, just like, I'll learn French on my own time. Just stop yelling at me.
All right, Katie, here's your last quote.
For fonder farewells, please use the parking lot.
That is a new sign at an airport in New Zealand, the first in the world to institute a rule limiting what to 3 minutes or less.
Like a goodbye hug?
Yes!
Yes!
Citing the delays caused by long goodbyes, an airport in New Zealand is now limiting hugs in the drop-off zone to 3 minutes or less. So get ready to look over from that long hug and see a TSA agent standing there with a stopwatch and a taser.
They're going to regret the specificity of that language, of that word hug, when people are like, well, technically we're having sex. I'm not... My arms aren't anywhere near her.
Which, I mean, still, you can get done in 3 minutes if you got a flight. You know. My thing is, and I don't know what airports, I guess it's different in New Zealand. Any airport I've been to, you can't have your car parked in front for 3 minutes.
Yeah. Right?
You stop, and that cop's like, wait a minute, keep moving. So.
I mean, I would love to meet the bitter, lonely, can't get a ride to the airport ass person who came up with this
one. This is from an airport in New Zealand, which I feel like this is so off-brand for New Zealand that I'm convinced this is one airport official in New Zealand who just has a really clingy mother. Who's just like, honey, and he's like, Mom, I know, but the rules, and also,
Mom,
can't feel my left shoulder anymore. I'm sorry, I have to go.
Well, it could be the fact that every flight from New Zealand is so long that you got to say goodbye like, you know, I may never see you again. You're about to board this 19-hour flight to civilization.
That's true.
Oh, like flying Spirit Airlines. It's like, this hug going to be long. Because I might not make it out of the bad neighborhood that is this plane.
A three-minute long hug is a really long hug.
No, it's not!
Yes, it is!
What is wrong with y'all? 3 minutes is not a long time!
Listen, you can microwave 2 frozen burritos in 3 minutes. Do you know how much you can get done in 3 minutes? That is an epic hug, 3 minutes.
All right. Bill, how did Katie do on our quiz?
She's a champion. She got them all right.
Yay!
Go, Katie.
Good going, Katie.
Don't worry, Katie. I do your voicemail, girl.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Right now, panel, time for you to answer some questions from this week's news. All right. Now, Alonzo, if you work in New York City, a new bill says that you can use a sick day not just when you're sick, but also when your what is sick?
Your dog, your pet.
Yes!
Yeah, absolutely.
When your dog is sick. A New York City councilman is introducing a law that would require employers to let people use sick days if their dog is sick. Now, it makes sense because you don't want to be the guy in the office who gave everybody heartworms.
Well, this is an interesting law in New York because they're New Yorkers. If a New Yorker calls in sick and you say, what's wrong with you? You get none of your business. I'm sick.
Yeah.
And they go on about, you know, their day.
Do you have to prove, like, do you have to get on a Zoom call with your boss and hold up, you know, Buddy, and Buddy's just like...
And what if it's one of those breeds that always looks sick?
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
that's
a,
just
like a Frenchie or yeah, something yeah. That's just like... And you're like, see? He can't even breathe. Come on.
Also,
I don't know about all these anti-dog people, but if my dog is sick, I ain't showing up.
Yeah, all right. We're clapping that, because that's the most American nonsense I've ever heard. Like, sick days for dogs and Amazon employees don't get any? If I was an Amazon employee, I would start dressing up like a shih tzu, just so I could get a couple of days off.
Coming up, our panelists send their greetings in our Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
North Carolina is seen by many as a must-win state for Donald Trump. A key part of his constituency there, conservative Christians.
You can have some people with some pretty deep moral struggles who are upholding a platform that we support.
One North Carolina religious leader on why Trump's support from conservative Christians runs so deep. That's on All Things Considered.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 5 o'clock this afternoon on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from the KU School of Music, inviting KU alumni to return to the 100th Annual Vespers Choir, singing alongside fellow alumni while commemorating a century of Vespers tradition on Sunday, December 8th. Details at music.ku.edu. Today on 105 Live, the in-studio guest is jazz instrumentalist Eddie Moore, the Electric Group, recorded live at the Bottleneck in Lawrence. Plus, we'll have new music from Wichita, Manhattan, and Lawrence. Join Nick Carswell for 105 Live today at 5 o'clock on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $60 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of more than 504,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. And Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Adam Burke, Alonzo Bowden, and Helen Hong. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal. It's Dulce Sloan.
Love the Listener Game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on air or check out the pinned post on our Instagram page at WaitWaitNPR. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Kristen from Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh! I've been to Pittsburgh. What you doing, Pittsburgh, girl?
I'm a high school teacher, and in my spare time, I volunteer at a cat rescue called Pittsburgh Cat.
Yeah!
Oh. All right.
Thank you for helping the kitty cats. It's so nice to have you, Kristen. Now, you're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. What's the topic, Bill?
Greeting cards in the news.
Ooh. Greeting cards, the perfect way to tell someone you do care about them, but not enough to send an actual gift. Our panelists are going to tell you about an incident involving a greeting card that made the news this week. Pick the one who's telling the truth, and you'll win our prize, the Wait Waiter of your choice, on your voicemail. Are you ready to play, Kristen?
I am ready.
Hey, first up, it's Helen Hong.
Getting laid off is never fun. But getting laid off and not even getting a goodbye card from your coworkers? Well, that's just criminal. That's what a woman claimed in court when she sued British Airlines for not giving her a farewell card when she left the company. The cardless woman, who happened to be named Karen, was so offended that she took legal action. Cardless Karen and the obviously not great lawyer who took on her case had a rude awakening in court when a former colleague testified that they did buy a card, but they didn't give it to her because only three people signed it. Awkward. Undaunted, Cardless Karen is now preparing lawsuits against a busload of strangers who didn't all say bless you after she sneezed.
A greeting card lawsuit from Helen Hong. Your next noteworthy note card comes from Adam Burke.
Nothing says you care for someone like a homemade greeting card, and nothing says you really care for them like getting a professional to make it for you. But not everyone can afford their own writers and artists, which is where bespoke greeting card startup Heart Murmurs comes in. The Iowa-based company seeks to automate the process by using AI to write and design cards tailored to your loved ones, explains founder Hans Bowman. For our initial testing, we wanted to see what we'd get with zero human intervention. It was here the limitations started to show, with participant Lisa Crowther having to apologize to her 72-year-old mother after the latter received a gaudily decorated card that read, "Roses are red, and neither are you. F. Patrick Mahomes, you're 72. As Bowman explains, the AI scrubs your social media to sound more like you, so if you say a lot of profane things about the Chiefs, that might come up. Even more bizarre were some of the attempts at festive missives, with one Ellis Hoskins getting her card reading, "Happy holidays, Ellis. Santa is coming for you. There is no escape. Ho, ho, ho." Clearly we've got some work to do, says Bowman.
All right. AI going a little too far from Adam Burke. And your last story of some paper in the paper comes from Alonzo Bowden.
When Motor Week magazine writer Peter Seat finally met with the famous Airbags Car Club in Detroit, it wasn't just their collection of old cards that stood out. It was their collection of greeting cards. What's with all the cards? Well, founding Airbags member Gonzo Raymond isn't just the owner of a 1963 Impala convertible. He's also the owner of some very passionate opinions about e-cards. Turns out he hates them. So everyone started sending him cards. Not just birthday and Christmas cards, cards for everything. Did you know April 14th is National Ex-Spouse Day? January 21st is Squirrel Appreciation Day? National Left-Handers Day is August 13th. They even got him a card for nothing on January 16th, because that's National Nothing Day.
Okay, Kristen. You've got Helen's story about a woman suing for not getting a farewell card, only to realize she had one. It was just too pathetic to give to her. Adam's story about an AI company writing cards that are a little too personal. And from Alonzo Bowden, e-cars turn an old car collector into a greeting card collector. Which story is the real story?
Okay, this is pretty tough, but I think I'm going to go with Adam's story because as a teacher, I encounter a lot of bad AI sometimes from students who are rushed to get an assignment in.
Oh, okay. Well, to find out the correct answer, we spoke to someone covering the real story.
They discovered that the company had a card for Karen, but only two or three people were actually willing to sign it.
That was Allison Levins from the Hammer and Nigel show talking about the real story of the card no one wanted to sign. I'm sorry, Kristen, but Helen had the real answer.
That's so good.
I'm sorry you didn't win, but you did earn a point for Adam. Thanks for playing with us. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Like a fool, I went and stayed too long. I'm wondering if your love's still strong.
And now it's time for a game we call Not My Job. Basketball and soccer legends Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe are a true sports power couple with 7 Olympic medals, countless championships, and a Presidential Medal of Freedom between them. Oh, where y'all keep all these medals at? They're also the hosts of A Touch More, a show about women's sports that's, given their track record, will probably be the first podcast to win a Nobel Prize. Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me! Okay, so since y'all got all these accolades, do you prefer legends or ghosts? Like, how do you like to be referred to?
Legend.
Legend.
Okay. That's classy. So, I do have a question about y'all's podcast. It's called A Touch More, correct? Now, I want to know, how did you shift the podcast from, like, a tipsy Instagram live to, like, a full podcast?
Well, we took out the tipsy part. That helps. Got a couple of Google Docs going, and That's basically it.
That's basically it.
We're pretty much doing the same thing.
We have no idea what we're doing.
Sam's
is really what it is.
I know. We're like, who gave us these jobs? We did.
So, Miss Sue, who's a dream guest for the podcast?
A dream guest. I mean, we wouldn't mind having Kamala Harris on, so that would be nice.
This is Have Megan, you... praying for President Harris.
Yeah.
Have you called Beyonce? Because she knows her.
She's got an in.
Yeah.
I'll text her when we're done.
Be like, hey, Beyonce, we need Ms. Harris's number. Thank you.
Okay, now, I do have some questions. Y'all are like just like this, you know, super sports power couple, just the strongest calves of any relationship. I do have a question. Since y'all are just these iconic, like, legends of sports, do you remember watching each other play, like, before y'all met each other? Did y'all, like, were y'all fans of each other before y'all met? Megan?
Megan says yes.
Megan watched me in college. How do we feel about this?
Yeah, I do wonder, like, are y'all very competitive because you are sports? So it makes sense, you know, medals and stuff. A family game night. Is it better if y'all are on the same team or opposing teams?
Megan won't play games, y'all. Like, Megan won't play games. It's so frustrating.
Really?
She won't play cards. She won't play anything.
I'll play some cards, but I don't like to be competitive in life. Even on the field, I was like...
Bro, what? You have medals. They gave you a big ass shoe.
I always figured the person who won 4 World Cups wasn't that competitive.
I mean, we were gonna win, you know.
I like that. So there's 7 Olympic medals, there's championships, there's a giant shoe, a medal of freedom. Where do y'all put all these awards? Does your living room just look like a high school lobby? Like,
We actually have none of it in the house.
None of it.
What? It's all like in storage or in a safe or
something. So one year we decided, let's be smart about this and buy a safe. So we bought like one of those, you know, small ones, whatever you put in like a closet, and then we put it in there, but we never got to the part where you have to, like, drill it into the wall. So somebody could just really come and take the safe is really what I'm saying.
This sounds like the most insane episode of Storage Wars in about 10 years.
I'm just thinking of all the people you two have beaten for championships and medals and honors, and they're like, they don't even care. I trained my whole life. They don't even care. The medal's locked away somewhere.
I cried when I lost.
And there's an unsecured safe just floating around somewhere.
I could have just waited and got a jackhammer.
Basically.
Yeah.
Might as well be in a shoebox. Jeez.
It was at one point. It was. Yeah, this is the upgrade.
Wow!
Are you against just being ostentatious? Do you feel like it's too flashy? It's too gaudy? Like, why don't you have these...
A little bit, yeah.
Really?
You are?
And, like, you're not going to wear them. They're heavy.
If I won a giant shoe, I would be wearing that thing around my neck every single day.
I would like your podcast to start with the sound of you just taking all your medals off. Clunk, 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 clunk.
It's the first 20 minutes of everything.
It's actually her.
Well, all right, Sue and Megan, we've asked you here today to play a game we're calling...
Partners in Literal Crime.
So you two are a famous power couple. So we decided to ask you about an infamous power couple, Bonnie and Clyde, who also have 7 Olympic medals for grapevine.
I want to know where they keep theirs.
In their coffins. Because they dead. Now, answer 2 of 3 questions right, and you'll win a prize for one of our listeners, the voice of anyone from our show on their voicemail. Bill, who are Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe playing for?
Ren Hauptman of Seattle, Washington.
Hey! friends, here's your first question. Bonnie and Clyde committed crimes across the U.S. in a stolen car before being gunned down by Texas Rangers. A surprising thing happened after their death. What? A, the local baseball team decided to change their name from the Texas Bank Robbers to the Texas Rangers. B, their life insurance policy was fully paid out because insurance companies did not yet have an exception for dying while committing a crime spree. Or C, the next year, the site of the shootout became the top location for weddings in all of Texas.
Yeah, I enjoy the whispering.
Why?
Okay, let's keep going. Megan thinks it's C.
Okay.
Oh, my.
Wow. And Miss Suber,
do you agree
with your partner?
Yeah, final answer.
Do you agree?
We're going to go B.
The
joint
it is.
Together.
The answer is B. Their life insurance policy was fully paid.
You did it, Joe.
Here's your next question. Bonnie and Clyde are two of the most famous criminals of all time, but Frank Kamer, the Texas Ranger who finally caught them, has his own claim to fame. What? He's A, one of the earliest people on record to use the phrase bust a cap. B, he's the Frank that Frankfurters are named after. Or C, he hit number one on the charts with a song called I Shot Bonnie and Clyde. He's one
okay,
of
A,
the-
A. It's B.
You know what? Actually, yeah, it's A. Yes. Shootout, Hamer said, quote, I hate to bust a cap on a woman. However, if it wouldn't have been her, it would have been us. And gangster rap was changed forever. What a thing to learn. All right.
Yeah.
Here is your last question. Bonnie and Clyde have a preferred getaway vehicle, the Ford V8 Model B. Apparently, Clyde loved the car so much that he once did what? A, got a tattoo of one on his arm next to the word Zoom. B, called the editor of the Dallas Morning News, insisting the paper referred to them as Bonnie and Clyde and their Ford V8 Model B. Or C, wrote Henry Ford a letter praising the car, quote, sustained speed and freedom from trouble.
Sue thinks it's A.
I can read the answer.
I think it's C.
The answer is C. But sadly for Ford, everyone knows that today the best getaway car is the Nissan Altima. Bill, how did Sue and Megan do on our quiz?
Proving they are always winners.
They got the pose. Come on, medals.
We would send you a trophy, but what would be the point?
Going to a storage unit in Silver Lake anyway. Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe are legends in their respective sports. New episodes of their podcast, A Touch More, drop every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. So Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe! Thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Young B, cruising down the west side highway, doing what we like to do. Eyes behind shades, this necklace, the reason all of my days.
In just a minute, we reveal the underground wedding scene in our listener limerick challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
We hear from voters in a Pennsylvania county that has a reputation for picking the president in each election.
It's difficult for people in the middle class, if you can call them middle class anymore, to get a leg up.
Plus, a new film explores a political battle to pick a new pope. We speak with actor Ralph Fiennes, star of Conclave, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition Monday morning from 5 to 9 o'clock here on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.9 Atchison. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classic trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. And from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, offering a local team to help businesses invest in the health of their employees with a choice of benefits. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business. Highs in the mid-60s today, under sunny skies. It's 48 in Lawrence.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Indeed. Designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. JTV Jewelry Television, offering a variety of gemstone jewelry with more than 70 different gemstones available. JTV can be found on TV or at jtv.com. And Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Helen Hong, Adam Burke, and Alonzo Bowden. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal, it's Dulce Sloan.
Hey! Thank you! In just a minute, Bill has dinner with Busta Rhymes and our listener Limerick Challenge. If you'd like to play, call us at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. But right now, panel, some more questions from the week's news. Adam?
Yep.
Now, you're familiar with TechNet, right?
Nope.
Okay. You're not up on the latest terms. So TechNet, the Quasimodo look you get after staring at your phone all the time, okay, right? Well, this week we read about a new way to get rid of it. What is it?
Throw your phone into the river.
Okay. What about a way to cover it up?
Oh, cover up tech. Is it like where, like, we're one of those travel pillows all the time?
You might say not all heroes.
Oh, is it? Oh, they're special, like TechNet capes.
Yes, they are telling people
what?
To wear a cape to cover up your TechNet. If you weren't getting beat up enough. We're all, you know, crumbled over our phones 100 hours a day, giving our neck that fresh off of a, you know, roller coaster accident look. And it's called tech neck, or as your mother used to call it, stand up straight!
But now you can look like Supergirl doing it.
Or like, the crappiest superhero. It's Instagram Stalker Man!
I don't understand how the cape covers up the hunchback. Doesn't it make you just look like you have a hunchback with a cape on it?
No, that's what the pleats are for, Helen. The pleats.
Yeah.
Well, we also have the increasing intensity of these storms. Now, God forbid you're wearing your cape. When a Category 4 blows in, you are gone. What happened to him? Oh, that cape was tied a little too tight. Last seen floating over Indiana, I don't know.
So, when your cape gets caught in a revolving door and you get strangled to death, they'd be like, well, at least he doesn't have tech neck.
He has no neck. But he's fine now. Helen.
Yes?
Companies are trying a new way to capture buyers' attention in the store. It's packaging their products. How?
Packaging their products. I think I need a hint.
You thought you were getting M&Ms, but surprise, it's paperclip.
Packaging their products in just the completely wrong packaging?
That is right!
What?
In a trend called chaos packaging.
perfume and cleaner spray bottles, gin and motor oil containers, and for when you accidentally drink motor oil thinking it's gin, just look for your first aid kit in a nearby soup can.
What?
Like, companies are doing this for the same consumers that are eating Tide Pods in the correct packaging.
Isn't this called fraud?
I would think so, but also, and this is true, there's an ice cream tub of tampons!
Oh, man.
It's either brilliant marketing or Ben and Jerry's worst flavor ever.
This is definitely somebody at the factory quiet quitting. Like, quiet quitting really hard, and then just being like, you know, just put motor oil on.
No. I don't know. Does this work both ways? Can I take a can of peas to Nordstrom and say, I'm returning these designer shoes. I'd like my money back.
Ooh, that's good. Or I can take my ex and return him to his mom and be like, hey, you lied to me. On the outside, he was a good man, but on the inside, he's trash. I brought a receipt. Here, ma'am, take him back. Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank. But first, it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can catch us most weeks, including next week for a fun Halloween show, right here at the beautiful Studebaker Theater in Chicago! We'll be back at the Fox Theater in Detroit on the 14th of November. You can also join us in New York City at Carnegie Hall in December. For tickets and info, go to nprpresents.org. Also, check out this week's How to Do Everything. Ian and Mike help you optimize your Halloween candy and talk to the Fonz himself about how to be a cool. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
How is everybody? My name is John Blankenship.
And where are you from?
My family and I live in Franklin, Tennessee, just a few minutes south of Nashville.
I have been through Franklin, Tennessee. It is very nice. And what do you do for a living?
I work at a small digital marketing agency that one of my best friends started a couple of years ago.
I don't know what that job does. Welcome to the show, John.
I don't know what the job does half the time either. It's okay.
We're in the same boat. All right. Bill Curtis is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly on two limericks, you're a winner, baby! Now, here is your first limerick.
On a rail car, don't dress like a schlub, hey. And don't stand in the cheap catered grub's way. Champagne corks will pop as they're calling out stops, 'cause our wedding is held on the
subway?
Yes.
That's right.
Good one.
In nasty news, there's a growing trend where people are holding weddings and receptions on the subway. It's perfect if your only guests are breakdancers, a mariachi band, and a tall person coughing directly onto a short person's head.
Is this in New York City?
Yes! And according to the New York Times, the N Train is the most sought-after wedding venue this year, and the wedding DJ is some guy watching YouTube without headphones.
I wouldn't mind going on a morning commute and suddenly being like, yeah, I'll have some cake, sure, yeah. Pass me some champagne.
When the train stops, just randoms jump on the train and like, hey, look, we're at a wedding.
Yeah, you can't hold up the car. It's Babylon every time you get on a train car anyway. All right, here is your next limerick.
My love for green foods began rockily, but I know that they're good for me, luckily. And that sulfurous smell helps my body feel well. Now I'll really start eating more.
Broccoli.
Hey! Broccoli! Jonathan! The New York Times clearly had some extra time this week. Because after a thorough investigation, they're reporting that broccoli is healthy!
What?
I mean, of course it is. Look at it. It's a tiny tree.
So did they have like a guest editor this week that was just every mother from the 1970s?
Or some type of farm-to-table con job where somebody's like, I got this broccoli, you got to push. Call my brother at the New York Times.
Yeah, what? Big cauliflower couldn't afford it.
Because it was too busy being pizza. All right, Jonathan, here's your last limerick.
This resort meal is scenic and cool, but I got my eggs wet like a fool. There's chlorine in my drink. Drop my fork, now it sinks. Still, I love breakfast served in the
pool.
Hey! The fun new way for rich people to be ridiculous is to eat breakfast in the pool. The Washington Post reports that this is popular with influencers and other people trying to convince you to eat wet toast.
Also, were the Washington Post and the New York Times having a competition for the dumbest article?
Definitely a slow week on the news desk.
Phil, how did John do?
John is a perfect player.
Hey!
Hey!
Thank you, John, for listening.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on with you all. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, friend.
Have a good one, John.
Take care.
Thank you.
Grits and gravy.
Grits and gravy.
Cheese, eggs, and jam. Oh. Can't nobody cook it like you, girl. No, ma'am. This here early morning. Need something else on my plate. I think I want another.
Now on to our final game. Lightning fill in the blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as they can. Each correct answer is worth 2 points. Bill, can you give us the scores?
Adam and Helen each have 3. Alonzo has 2.
All right, Alonzo, you're in third place, yes. So you're up first. Fill-in-the-blank. During her CNN town hall on Wednesday, Kamala Harris said she believes that Donald Trump is a wood.
Wow. We're just going to leave that open like that. I think it was fascist.
Yes. This week, states reported that over 28 million people had blanked early.
Voted.
Yes. This week, the U.S. announced that ceasefire talks with blank would resume.
Israel?
Yes. On Tuesday, the International Monetary Fund said that global blank rates have continued to fall.
Interest.
Inflation rates.
Oops.
Is that the same thing? Last week, the BBC apologized after their weather app forecasted blank in London.
Pennies from heaven?
13,000 mile per hour wind.
That was my next guess.
Absolutely. On Thursday, the New York Liberty was honored with a ticker tape parade after winning the blank championship.
WNBA.
Hey! This week, it was revealed that the big secret behind a German restaurant's best-selling pizza was that it came with the side of...
pizza from Italy?
I know this one. Do you know this one?
I know this
one.
Yeah.
Cocaine! So police said that anyone who ordered the number 30, you know, they thought it was weird. It would come with, like, breadsticks to drink and, like, a bag of cocaine. And weirdly enough, the same thing happened at that Chuck E. Cheese where the animatronic band was really into EDM. Bill, how did Alonzo do?
4 right, 8 more points, total of 10 puts him in the lead.
Okay, Adam, you're up next. Fill in the blank. After an E. coli outbreak linked to the restaurant, blank said its food is safe to eat.
McDonald's.
Right. On Thursday, the DA in Los Angeles announced plans to resentence the blank brothers.
The Menendez.
Right. This week, the White House confirmed that North Korea was sending soldiers to aid blank's war against Ukraine.
Russia.
Right. On Tuesday, it was ruled that Rudy Giuliani must turn over his Manhattan apartment to the blank workers he defamed.
Election workers?
Right. Weeks after it was discovered that many zoo pandas were just dogs in disguise, a shark at an aquarium in China was found to be a blank.
A panda in disguise.
A robot. On Tuesday, LeBron James made history by playing in an NBA game with his blank.
Son.
Right. On Wednesday, a Polish radio station announced it had replaced all its journalists with blank.
AI?
Right. This week, it was revealed that a team of hackers successfully overrode robot vacuums around the country and forced them to blank.
Rise up against their human oppressors.
And forced them to chase their human oppressors' pets around the house. The company that makes the vacuum said not only were the hackers able to remotely control the vacuums to chase pets around, but they were also able to talk through the built-in speakers, which raises the question, why does a vacuum need speakers?
If
no one's ever been like, man, I love my vacuum. I just wish it was louder.
If my Roomba's chasing my cat, can I call in sick in New York?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Bill, how did Adam do?
He got 6 rights, 12 more points, and the total is 15 in the lead.
Okay. So, Bill, how many does Helen need to win?
6 to tie, 7 to win.
Helen, you ready for the game?
I'm ready.
Okay, sis. On Wednesday, striking airplane mechanics again rejected a contract offer from blank.
Boeing.
Ha! Right. On Monday, aid workers warned of dire conditions for refugees trapped in blank.
Gaza.
Right. On Friday, President Biden formally apologized for the government's role in boarding schools that stripped blank of their culture and language.
Native Americans.
Right. For the first time, Vice President Kamala Harris said she supported raising the blank to $15 an hour.
Federal minimum wage.
Right. This week, footage revealed a sheriff in Georgia had called in 3 deputies for backup when he blanked.
Clogged a toilet.
When he got the wrong order at Burger King. This week, investigators confirmed that a newly opened fire station in Germany burned down because the fire department forgot blank.
Pay the water bill.
They forgot fire alarms.
Because they were eating pizza with cocaine on it.
Now, the firefighters could have saved it. The problem is they're taught to go down the pole. No one's ever taught them how to go back up. Bill, did Helen do well enough to win?
4 right, 8 more points, total of 11, means Adam Burke is the winner this week.
Congratulations, Adam. You are this week's champion. Now, coming up, our panelists predict, after the 3-minute-long hug, what will be the next surprising rule at the airport. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well. From everyday repairs to major remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. And Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Hair Care Productions, Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our public address announcer is Paul Friedman. Our tour manager is Shayna Donald, thanks to the staff and crew at the Studebaker Theater. DJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Jennifer Mills, Miles Dornbos, and Lillian King. Special thanks to Blythe Robertson and Biniam Bazuna and Monica Hickey. This week, Peter Gwynn goes by Dulce Gwynn. Emma Choi is our vibe curator. Technical direction is by Lorna White. Our CFO is Colin Miller. Our production manager is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what will be the next rule at the airport? Alonzo Bowden.
The don't you know who I am people are not allowed to board the airplane because they don't know who they are.
Helen Hong.
If you get randomly selected for a pat-down inspection, the TSA officer first has to have a staring contest with you for 3 minutes.
And Adam Burke.
If your plane is a Boeing, your boarding pass will have a handy last will and testament printed on the back.
Well, if any of that happens, we're going to ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Bill Curtis! Thanks also to Adam Burke, Helen Hong, and Alonzo Bowden. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Dulce Sloan, and we'll see you next week. is NPR.
And this is your place for NPR News and for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And coming up next here on Kansas Public Radio, it's the Moth Radio Hour. We're Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from The Lead Center, hosting comedian Lewis Black in Goodbye Yeller Brick Road, the final tour, Saturday, November 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at lead.ku.edu. Sunny skies today. We're looking for highs in the mid-60s. It's 52 degrees in Topeka. This is KPR.
Every time I get a letter from home, the first thing I do is I tear the return address into little pieces, because if I don't, somebody might fish the envelope out of the trash and write to my family and my friends. They could demand money from them and make it really clear what will happen if they don't listen.
Next up, the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Before a Live Audience. I'm Meg Bowles, and in this hour, we'll hear stories of split-second decisions, life-changing mistakes, and braving the road ahead.
And that's when I lost the horizon. There was no left, there was no right, there was no up, there was no down, and there definitely was not a license plate in front of me. I figured I could put my foot on the gas and try to catch up to Tony, or I could just drive right off the edge of this damn cliff and go 3,000 feet to my death.
All that and more coming up next on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX, right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Israeli military launched strikes on military targets in Iran overnight. The attacks come as the Biden administration has pushed for months to avoid a wider war in the region. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
A senior administration official told reporters the United States did not participate in Israel's military operation, though President Biden had encouraged Israel to pursue a targeted response. And the U.S. official says that is what has transpired. The Israeli military has said these strikes were in retaliation for months of continuous attacks from Iran against Israel. The Biden administration official says this should now be the end of the direct exchange of fire between Israel and Iran, though if Iran responds, the United States is prepared to help Israel. The White House insists its aim in the region is to de-escalate tensions. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
The president told reporters today that intelligence officials say it appears the strikes only hit military targets. Israeli forces have raided a hospital compound in North Gaza, according to the Ministry of Health. That says Israeli troops have besieged areas in the north since early this month. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
In a video statement, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk called what is happening in the north, quote, one of the darkest moments in the Gaza conflict.
The Israeli military is subjecting an entire population to bombing, siege, and starvation.
Israeli forces breached the Kamal Adwan Hospital, detaining all male staffers and putting women in a room without food or water, according to the Ministry of Health. The hospital had already been struggling to treat its nearly 200 patients. On Friday, the Israeli military said it was operating in the area of the hospital based on intelligence of, quote, terrorists and terrorist infrastructure. It did not respond to NPR's request for further comment. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
For the first time since 1988, the Washington Post is not endorsing a candidate for president. Washington's hometown paper is known for its political coverage. It broke the Watergate story during the Nixon administration. NPR's David Folkenflik broke this story. He says the paper's stated reason for the non-endorsement was it wanted to return to its roots, independent of partisan interests. But there may be other factors.
That's happening against a backdrop in which Trump has been attempting to directly and expressly intimidate the press, saying that if he wins office once more, that he will wreak vengeance against it. And if you think about Jeff Bezos, yes, he's the owner of the Post, but of course, the founder of Amazon. He has a ton of business interests worth billions involving the federal government. Amazon's shipping, its cloud computing contracts, and his space company, Blue Origin, has a multi-billion dollar deal with the federal government to take people into the heavens.
NPR's David Folkenflik. More than 1,600 customers canceled their subscriptions within 3 hours after the story broke. This is NPR News. A video widely circulated on social media Thursday purported to show mail-in ballots for Donald Trump being destroyed in Pennsylvania. The FBI said yesterday it's a fake and was manufactured by Russia. Local election officials in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, had debunked the video within hours, saying the envelopes and ballots shown were not the ones the county uses. Federal officials say the fake was part of Moscow's broader effort to raise unfounded questions about the integrity of the U.S. election. Bass player Phil Lesh has died. He was one of the founding members of the Grateful Dead. His family posted on Instagram he died yesterday. Lesh didn't even know how to play the bass when Jerry Garcia asked him to join his band that became the Grateful Dead and came to define the 1960s acid rock sound. Phil Lesh was 84. The Los Angeles Dodgers defeated the New York Yankees 6-3 in Game 1 of the World Series last night. Steve Futterman reports from Dodger Stadium.
This has to go down as one of the most memorable World Series games in history. There was such a buildup before this series. The Dodgers and Yankees, New York, Los Angeles, Shohei Ohtani and Aaron Judge. And in the end, Game 1 ends on a dramatic walk-off Grand Slam home run. The Dodgers were down to their final out. They were trailing 3-2. That's when Freddie Freeman hit the Grand Slam. The Dodgers win Game 1, 6-3, and Freddie Freeman is the hero. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles.
Game 2 is tonight, also in Los Angeles. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Meg Bowles, and in this hour, we bring you four stories that deal with the aftermath of wrong turns and the process of figuring out a way through. Sometimes a hastily made choice can lead down a perilous road, which was quite literally the case for our first storyteller, Julie Pryor, who shared this story at an evening we produced in partnership with the Anchorage Concert Association. From the Atwood Concert Hall in Anchorage, Alaska, here's Julie Pryor live at the Moth.
So I was 3 years old when the moving truck pulled into the driveway of my new home in New Jersey. And my dad lifted me up, and he put me in the cab of the truck, and he pointed to the rope hanging from the ceiling, and he said, "Pull that." So I did what I was told. I stood up, and I pulled that rope with all of my might, and I was terrified by the sound it made. It was an air horn. I was terrified, but Dad was smiling. He looked at me and he said, "Good. Now the neighbors know we're here. We have arrived." Dad ran the Mayflower Moving Company out of Orange, New Jersey, and he loved trucks. Big trucks, little trucks, refrigerated trucks, all the trucks. And he had a deep respect for truck drivers. So I was thinking about my dad a couple decades later when I was standing in a truck yard in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was producing a documentary for the History Channel about the notorious Hall Road, which connects the city of Fairbanks to the oil fields on the North Slope. And it was my job as the producer to help convey the stories of the truckers, the men and the women who were bold or crazy enough to drive this road year-round, hauling supplies to the North Slope. I thought I knew what I was doing. I did my research. I Googled Alaska Haul Road. I read what it said. It was the loneliest road on the planet. Avalanches could kill you. Or my personal favorite was the road where hell froze over. But see, I figured these were just written by people who had never actually been there. But when I found myself in that truck yard in Fairbanks and I was looking at these truckers, they had most definitely been there. I could tell by their worn Carhartt jackets and their trapper hats and their amazing beards. And it's at this moment that I realize just how clean and ridiculous and purple my North Face jacket looks in comparison. But there was no time to be embarrassed, because the foreman of the crew came over to our very urban-looking film crew, and he starts barking at us like that drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket, and he says, "Which one of you knuckleheads is going to drive the chase truck?" So the chase truck is the final truck in the convoy, and it's the one carrying all of the film crew's gear to the North Slope. Now, none of the boys that I was working with volunteered to drive, but this foreman didn't wait for a response. He just tossed the keys up into the air. And that's when I saw my hand reach up and snatch the keys. So I got the keys now, and the boys that I'm working with, they disperse into their separate trucks with their cameras and whatnot. And I just walk over to my cab, to the cab of the truck, hop up, jump in, slam the door shut, and that's when I panicked. Like, really panic. Like, what the hell do I think I'm doing? Who do I think I am? Oh, my God, I can't do this. I can't do this. Which reminded me of when I was 14, and my dad tossed me the keys to his pickup truck because he was too drunk to drive. And I started listing all the reasons why I really shouldn't drive. I said, "Dad, I'm 14. I don't know how to drive. It's illegal." Dad didn't care. He just walked around the other side of the truck, hopped into the passenger seat, sat down, reclined the seat fully, and closed his eyes. Okay? So I climb into my dad's truck. I put the key in the ignition, and I turn the truck on, and boom, there's Willie Nelson. Dad loved Willie. And he had Willie's greatest hits on a tape jammed into the cassette player. So every time you got into the truck, there would be Willie singing. You had no idea what song it was, but it was going to be Willie. This time it was On the Road Again. Appropriate. So finally Dad turns and he looks at me and he says, "You ready?" "No." "Good. Get to know the four corners of the truck, adjust your seat, the mirrors, and when you're ready, put your damn foot on the gas and drive us home." So back in Fairbanks, I adjust the seat, the mirrors, I try to get to know the four corners of this truck, put my foot on the gas, and I drove out onto the Great Alaska Haul Road. So I didn't kill myself in the first mile, and my confidence started to build. I'm like, this is pretty cool, right? So I start listening to the music, I think about coming up with a trucker handle, like Leadfoot Lizzie. But then my trucking fantasy came to a screeching halt when I saw the sign. This massive sign that said, 250 miles to the next service station. So I do the mental calculus, and I'm like, okay, 250 miles. So that's like driving from Boston to New York City without stopping once to pee or to get gas. There's no restaurants. There's no ATMs. There's no human beings, and I'm realizing as I pull my flip phone out of my purple jacket, there are no bars, there's no service. I am entirely alone. Every member of my crew is in a different truck. I am alone in this Ford F-350, and I was terrified. So the next 250 lonely miles to Coldfoot, which is this first service station on the Hall Road, Google didn't exactly tell me everything that was going to happen. So I knew it was 28 feet wide, but 28 feet wide feels really different when there's a double wide coming at you about 65 miles an hour. I learned about the roller coaster. This is not what I found on Google, only by the truckers and how terrifying that stretch was. Somehow, I made it in one piece to Coldfoot. And so we stopped to get some gas and get a bite to eat. And I head into the cafe, and I'm immediately blown away by the smell of the place. It's like this potent combination of bacon and kerosene and cigarettes. And these old-timers are hunched over the bar, and they're sharing war stories about the road, and there's pictures of wrecks, like, stapled to the walls. And these truckers are talking about the conditions on the pass. The ice, the fog, the snow, it sounds horrible. And the pass they're talking about is Adigan Pass, some 5,000 foot elevation in the Brooks Range, and it's the only thing standing between me and my destination. It's also the only road that is maintained by the Department of Transportation year round so that these truckers can deliver their supplies to the North Slope day in and day out. Truckers with experience, truckers with beards. Not me. So Tony, the big rig driver that I was following on this journey, could probably smell my fear at this point. And he turned and he looked at me and said, Julie, look it, I'm going to give you one piece of advice. Just stay close enough to my truck to see the license plate. Because as soon as you lose the license plate, you're probably going in the ditch. And only God can help you then. Great. I'm headed into certain death, and I have zero relationship with God. So I walk back to my Ford F-350, and I get in, and I'm thinking about my dad. My dad passed not long before this trip to Alaska. We had a very complicated relationship, but I'd like to think that in our final days, we found peace with one another. And one of the last things we did before he passed was we listened to his favorite song. It's a Willie song. Willie Nelson song, and it's called Poncho and Lefty. And it goes something like this. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing. Living on the road, my friend, is going to keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron. Your breath is as hard as kerosene. So back on the road, I'm in this truck, and we are headed north towards Brooks Range, whether I want to or not. And from a distance, it's gorgeous. It's just these majestic purple and blue mountains rising up out of the snow. But the closer I got to this pass, the more it resembled a giant, menacing ice wall. And I could see this line running across it. It looked like a scar. And as I traced it with my finger, it led back to the convoy and to my truck. That scar was the haul road, and I was about to drive it. So I gripped the steering wheel and I kept my eyes trained on Tony's truck as I slowly, about 15 miles an hour, followed him up and into the clouds. So in Adigan Pass, there are stretches that have a 12% grade. Now, I didn't know what 12% grade meant, but I learned very quickly that when you have chains on your tires and the gravel turns to ice and these tires are having difficulty maintaining control, that's what a 12% grade in Adigan Pass feels like. And this ditch to my right is getting more and more steep, and the fog is getting more and more dense, and then the snow starts to fly. And that's when I lost the horizon. There was no left, there was no right, there was no up, there was no down, and there definitely was not a license plate in front of me. I figured I could put my foot on the gas and try to catch up to Tony, or I could just drive right off the edge of this damn cliff and go 3,000 feet to my death. The alternative was worse. I could stop, but there's all sorts of trucks coming up behind me. So the options are bleak. And it's at that very moment that I heard Willie. His voice came through the speakers in my truck, and he was singing Poncho and Lefty. And I laughed. I laughed because his voice reminds me so much of someone that brought me comfort. And I laugh because if my dad were sitting next to me, he would be fully reclined with his eyes closed, cool as a cucumber. So I jammed my foot on the gas, and I hoped for the best. And like a miracle, out of the white, the most beautiful yellow and blue license plate materialized. And I crank Willie, and I start singing along, Now You Wear Your Skin Like Iron. And I follow Tony's truck up and over the pass and out of the clouds. And off in the distance, I know Prudhoe Bay is out there. And on this journey, I developed such a deep and profound respect for the men and the women that drive this crazy-ass road day in and day out. I knew today I was going to make it because I had Willie and my dad with me. And as I pulled my truck into Prudhoe Bay under those yellow industrial lights More than 5,000 miles from my childhood home in New Jersey, I honked my horn. I have arrived.
That was Julie Pryor's one and only time behind the wheel of a truck. She says, it was a stupid thing that I did, really, assuming I could drive the haul road with zero experience, but I grabbed the keys to that truck because of my dad. I didn't know it then, but I realize it now. I just wanted to make him proud.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean.
You can find a link to the History Channel documentary that Julie worked on called Alaska, Dangerous Territory, along with a few photos from Julie's adventure, on our website, themoth.org.
Your mama's only boy, but her favorite one, it seemed. She began to cry when you...
Our next story comes from Madeline Berenson. She told her story at a Moth Grand Slam we produced in Denver, Colorado, in partnership with local public radio station KUNC. Here's Madeline Berenson, live at the Moth.
In 1978, when I was 19 years old, I waited tables at a quaint little bistro in Austin, Texas. It was very of an era, the kind of place where pretty young women in slinky leotards and wrap skirts worked lunches, and fastidious older men who knew about food and wine worked dinner shifts. The owner of the bistro was a 60-something Mercedes convertible driving man named Bob, and he had hired me that summer when I was a carefree freshman at the University of Texas. But by December, I had gotten pregnant, my boyfriend and I had broken up, and I was the opposite of carefree. In fact, I had no idea what I was going to do. So as a first step, I told Bob my situation and asked how it would affect my employment. And he said, as long as you keep doing the job you're doing, it's fine. But then, a few weeks later, when I'd started having to loosen that slinky wrap skirt, Bob took me aside one day and asked when I intended to quit. And I said, I thought at my 6 month, and he freaked out and said, absolutely not, that he thought it was understood I would leave as soon as I started showing because, he said, and I quote, I cannot have any unattractive people working for me here. And he gave me 1 month to find another job. So I went home, called UT and dropped my classes because college was just impossible now. And then I cried a lot. The next week, my history professor called to find out why I had dropped his class. And when I told him what had happened, he told me two very interesting things. One, that firing someone for being pregnant is illegal. And two, that his ex-wife was an attorney who would be thrilled to represent me. And thus began Bob's 5-month-long nightmare. Because after key information was exchanged, Bob learned that not only could he not fire me, but now, since he had threatened to, he couldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. Have you ever seen a pregnant woman strut? It's kind of funny looking, actually, unless you're Bob, and then it's just revolting. But Bob's revulsion became an important source of strength for me, because it forced me to face what I feared most about becoming a young single mother, that I was unfit, incapable, shameful. And so every day, I worked really hard to prove otherwise. I learned to fillet Dover sole tableside and to skillfully remove plates. But most importantly, I learned that I was really good at taking care of people, even when it was hard, even when I didn't like them. I found a kind of corrective grace in creating happiness and comfort for others, and it centered me. And by the way, my customers loved that I was pregnant. They left me big tips, and they brought baby gifts, and in many ways that I have never forgotten, they told me that they wished me well. On my last shift, when I was 8.5 months pregnant, Bob sat in my section, ordered chicken crepes and a bottle of Gewürztraminer, and watched me until my last customer left. And then he asked me to sit down. And with shaking hands, he told me that of all the people who had ever worked for him, a group that included philanderers, drug addicts, and thieves, he was happiest to see me go. And I said, "What a mean thing to say." And I got up and left because I would not let him see me cry. I didn't see Bob again for 13 years. And then one night when I was waiting tables in what was then the best restaurant in town, I had a private party scheduled in my section, a wine club. And when they walked in, there was Bob among them, and my heart skipped a beat. He looked much older, frail even, and he didn't recognize me. And I confess, there was a part of me that wanted to fix that right away by marching up to him and telling him who I was and telling him that my wonderful son was 13 now and that we were well and happy, no thanks to him. But then a better part of me came to the rescue. And from the moment I opened their first bottle of exquisite wine, I transformed into the most elegant, professional version of myself I have ever been. Like breath, like air, I was there before need was felt, every gesture executed with invisible precision, no detail overlooked. And I felt Bob's admiration for me growing throughout the evening, and it fueled me further. And then, at the end of the night, as he was leaving, Bob took my hands in his, looked me in the eye, and said, "I don't know who you are or where you came from, but you are absolutely the finest waiter I have ever had the honor of being served by in my entire life." And I said, "What a kind thing to say." And I smiled.
Madeline Berenson is a writer and part-time ski instructor. She told me she's married to a man who, after over 22 years, still makes her heart skip a beat when she sees him from across the room. She's the mother of two sons, stepmother of two more, and now proudly enjoys the title of grandmother. Coming up, a man risks his life for a bag of pretzels, when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
This show is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance, home of Snapshot, offering a personalized rate on car insurance based on safe driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California or from all agents.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Kansas Public Radio comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental health is closely linked to overall health. And to visit a dentist regularly, dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. And from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, committed to a healthier future for all Kansans with healthcare coverage for businesses and their employees. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business. Sunny skies today, highs in the mid-60s. Looks like a gorgeous day. Winds from the east, 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 54 in Lawrence.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles. The stories in this hour all hinge on a misstep that took the storyteller off course. Our next storyteller, Michael Fisher, shared his story live on stage at the Mesa Art Center in Arizona. Here's Michael Fisher.
JR looks at me and he says, Do you realize that I could kill you right now, stash your body under your bunk, and just take the pretzels? And nobody would even know. JR and I are at the end of a hallway and around a corner. We're in a blind spot, and we both know it, as far from the guards as we can get. Both doors off of this floor are locked. It's 2013, and we're in a medium security prison in upstate New York. I hate being watched by the guards, but it's other inmates like JR that I really worry about. Every time I get a letter from home, the first thing I do is I tear the return address into little pieces, because if I don't, somebody might fish the envelope out of the trash and write to my family and my friends. They could demand money from them and make it really clear what will happen if they don't listen. It's happened to other guys in here. It could happen to me. Earlier today, when I returned from the package room with some other inmates from my floor, I made the long walk down the hall to where I bunk. And there were guys peeking their head out of every room along the way, just watching those of us who just come back, because they were clocking what was in the net bags slung over our shoulders. And JR was one of those men. He saw something he wants, and that something is my pretzels. And JR's question is not rhetorical. He could kill me right now. He's bigger than me, stronger than me. I'm no match for him, especially these days. I've been losing weight ever since I arrived in prison a few months ago. The food is partly to blame, but I think it's mostly depression that has me down to less than 160 pounds. I remember this guy during one of my first days locked up showing me his prison ID and saying, "I came in here with no one but the ugly old man on this ID, and I'm going to go home the same way." Message was pretty clear. You come in alone, you bid alone, you leave alone. Whatever happens in this moment is between me and JR, because just like everyone else in here, I'm on my own. Right now you might be thinking, this is really weird. A couple of inmates fighting over pretzels. So before I keep going, I just want to be clear. These are not just any pretzels. These are Snyder's honey mustard and onion pretzel pieces. If anyone's ever had them, you'll appreciate the difference. And it's the big bag. It's not the single serving. It's not like the little ones that you can get in a vending machine. So, you know, my life for these pretzels is a pretty even trade. In fact, the pretzels are worth more than me. I'm a file clerk over on A Tower. It would take me days at that job to afford this bag. Bag probably costs $3. I make 24 cents an hour. I'm worth nothing. I'm a net negative, actually, because depending on which expert you ask, each inmate costs the state upwards of $50,000 a year in food, housing, medical care. So the math says it makes sense for me to die defending these pretzels. But if I do die for them, the math isn't going to be my reason. Standing with JR, I can picture my mom making a lunch for me to take to school when I was a kid, packing up food she thinks I'll like, things she bought especially for me because she wants me to be healthy and hopes I'll have a good day. When I was in grade school, my mom used to pack me a lunch pretty much every morning, and every once in a while she would slip a note into the paper bag, you know, something small just to let me know that she loved me. Finding a note from her was the best part of my day because my mom was my favorite person in the world back then. And she probably did that with the notes when I was in middle school too, but I wouldn't know. By then I was throwing the bags away, unopened, as soon as I got to school. There was this food truck that would pull onto the blacktop every day at recess, and I would buy something there instead. That's what the cool kids did. I can still picture those lunches my mom made, rotting in a trash can. Apples going brown, meat going rancid, bread getting moldy as I run around the schoolyard, thinking I don't need her. You know, to be honest, the things that haunt me about my past aren't the choices that brought me to prison. It's the small, quiet things, like what I did with those lunches, that cut the deepest. I know that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I've caused much more harm doing plenty of other things, legal and illegal. But there's no perfect correlation between the gravity of my actions and how bad I feel about them. If I've learned anything in prison, it's that guilt is an imperfect science. I've never told my mom what I used to do with those lunches. I'm too ashamed that I abused her love and her care like that. She's never stopped supporting me, even now, and that only makes it harder to think about what I did. But now I'm with JR, thousands of miles away from her, and I finally had my chance to make the smallest of amends. Why am I standing in a prison hallway a few weeks past my 24th birthday, guarding a bag of pretzels with my life? Because my mom sent them to me. She sent them because she remembers how much I liked them as a kid, and she's trying to brighten my day. It's having the opposite effect, obviously, but she's trying. My mom sends me cards, even though I call her on the phone every few days, because she thinks it's good for the officers to see me getting mail. She thinks they'll be nicer to me if they're reminded that in addition to being an inmate, I'm also a human being who has a family. She wants them to know, just as she wants me to know, how much I'm loved. So the only person who's going to eat these pretzels while I'm still alive is me. I can tell JR wants to fight about this. He's got his head tilted to one side, his, you know, arms are crossed in front of him. He's just waiting for me to say the wrong thing. But my hands are in my pockets. I'm in disbelief, to be honest, that this is the type of stupid situation I find myself in these days. And I'm scared, but I try to keep my voice steady. If that's really where you're at, that you're going to kill somebody over pretzels, then I don't know what to tell you, man. They're not for sale. JR stares me down, weighing his options. I'm not arguing how easily he could kill me, and something about that seems to rob JR of the rage he needs to actually do it. Instead, he stomps off down the hallway, empty-handed. He's smart, and it's midday, so he's leaving it alone for now. He'll probably stab me in my sleep tonight for disrespecting him like that, for being so casual about his threat. And part of me hopes that does happen, because call me crazy, but I don't think there's anything better waiting for me up ahead. Prison teaches each person inside that the only way to right a wrong, the only way to repay a debt, is to suffer. In the Department of Corrections, only pain can answer for pain. I can never do enough, be sorry enough, rehabilitate enough. But if I suffer enough, if I pay for my mistakes, big and small, my tears, my time, my life, then maybe, someday, I'll be forgiven, if only by myself. So, maybe that suffering takes the form of JR, poking a few holes in me tonight. It would take my family forever to get my body back. I've heard the paperwork to pry a corpse from the state is a nightmare. They just won't let you go, even after you're dead. But that can't be the way this ends, because if there's one thing I owe my mom at this point, it's sparing her from having to bury me. I have to outlive her. It's quite literally the least I can do. So I stay up all night, reading beneath my little commissary lamp, listening for JR's footsteps. It doesn't feel safe to sleep, and the odds of violence seem lower in the daylight. The sun feels like a witness who can protect me, even though I know This isn't true. But JR doesn't pay me another visit. He keeps a cold distance instead. And a couple weeks later, he assaults somebody in the stairwell and gets sent to solitary confinement at some other prison. I wish that meant I could breathe easy. But pretty soon, some random new guy will be sleeping on JR's old bunk. In here, the devil I know is better than the devil I don't. I can't change much about the life I live now. God knows I can't change anything about my past, including how I treated my mom. I've been stuck, too ashamed to apologize to her, but too tormented to move on. And as strange as it sounds, something about hanging on to that bag of pretzels, come what may, makes me feel just a little bit better. Not because I like the pretzels all that much anymore. They're actually too salty for me these days. Hey, threatening me over food someday soon because I'm sure it's only a matter of time. My mom will never even know the standoff with JR happened, just like she doesn't know I threw away her lunch bags in the first place. But at least it's a moment, you know, one small moment where I've done the right thing. It's something I can build on. It's a time that I protected the love that she's always shown me instead of just throwing it away. Thank you.
Michael Fisher was released from prison in 2015 and completed his parole the following year. He was 26 years old with only a high school diploma. 4 years later, he had a bachelor's and two master's degrees. He now works as a writing mentor, teaching in a college credit humanities program for adults who have limited access to higher education. Michael's relationship with his mom improved a lot while he was in prison, and he's done his best to carry that forward and to remember it's always the right time to be grateful for her love. You can see a picture of Michael and his mother on our website, themoth.org. Coming up, one of the bravest people I've ever met, when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Clark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. And from Burt Nash, offering a wide range of services for youth and their families, including therapy, parent support, and case management. More information at burtnash.org. Sunny skies today, highs in the mid-60s. Warmer for tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s. It's 56 in Topeka.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles, and our last story comes from Carol Sepalu. Carol is a native Alaskan and has spent most of her life in the small city of Nome. I wanted to mention that Carol has had a permanent tracheostomy since 1999, the reason for which she'll share in her story. She has to cover the trach to be able to speak clearly and not run out of breath so quickly. She also wears a retainer of sorts that acts as a palate so she can speak. As a result, she's quite soft-spoken, and I was worried at first that it might be hard for listeners to hear her, even with the microphone. But when Carol took the stage, it felt like the entire audience drew closer. From the Atwood Concert Hall in Anchorage, Alaska, here's Carol Sepalu, live at the Moth.
I was on an ambulance stretcher when all of the screams from the people trying to save my life faded away. Everything went completely dark. I couldn't hear, and I couldn't see. The darkness terrified me. Even the pain and the horrific cries felt like heaven compared to this void of nothingness. That's when I begged earnestly for God to save me. I was 16 years old, depressed and intoxicated. I shot myself point blank in the face, and now I was fighting for my life. I don't remember the sound of the gun, but I do remember it slipping right before I pulled the trigger. Everything went completely dark, and that's when I didn't want to die anymore. I was medevaced on a small airplane from Nome to Anchorage. The doctors told my mother that my chances were 50-50, and if I survived, I would be legally blind, and they weren't sure if I would be able to talk again. In the hospital, as I was struggling to breathe, I fell into a vision. I walked into a fog when an old village appeared. My late-great-grandfathers were there, sitting on the ground as they beckoned for me. They looked young and perfect, wearing bird feather parkas, and smiles so big their eyes closed. They told me that everything was going to be okay, and that I had to come back because I was going to do great things. They also told me other things that I can't remember, but somehow I now feel. It was so peaceful there, and I felt no pain. I begged to stay, but I listened to them, and I came back with a powerful sense of purpose. The gunshot left a severe wound on my face and a permanent tracheostomy, a narrow tube that I breathe through. Yet somehow, just being alive felt like a blessing. I went through several years of painful surgeries before I finally decided to stop them. I wear a mask over my face because with it on, people seem to be nicer and they ask less questions. As the years passed by, the depression sank deeper. Everyone was supportive of me, but I felt guilty. And then one day in 2014, I woke up at noon. It was a beautiful summer day, and I didn't want to get out of bed. I was 233 pounds, unhappy and unhealthy. I knew I had to do something. A friend of mine was a marathon runner, and her posts on Facebook were always so inspiring. So that day, I decided I would go for a 2-mile run. I could only run to the end of the road, which was only a couple of blocks before running out of breath. But I made the decision to walk the rest of the way, and I did this every day. Pretty soon, those 2 blocks, they turned into 1 mile, and 1 mile turned into a few. And just like that, I sort of turned into Forrest Gump. I just felt like running, and I couldn't stop. That next year, I ran a local 8-mile race and a local half marathon. I just wanted to keep running. I entered a trail race in Louisiana with a friend where she ran a 62-mile race. And I decided to do a 20-mile race. It rained hard. I was miserably wet and cold the entire time. But as I sat around waiting for my friend to finish, I noticed the runners around me. I knew they were exhausted. I ran only 20 miles and I was done. These people were running 62 and 100 mile races and they were smiling. Their endurance, willpower, and determination inspired me greatly. If they could get joy out of doing something so difficult, I wanted that too. So I decided to train for an ultramarathon. It was hard at first, but as I ran more, I wanted to see how much farther I could go. I ran up in the mountains with my dog where I love to be. I thought about my ancestors a lot. They were the true ultra runners. For fun, they would do endurance races where they ran in a circle and the last one running would win. And they ran for a very long time. I felt healthier. I lost 80 pounds. I was happier. The depression was easier to manage. I felt stronger. I signed up for a 50-mile race in Alaska, up in the mountains, out in the middle of nowhere, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. It had rained heavily the night before, but it stopped shortly before sunrise when we all gathered together. The race director said a few words and sent us off. It was an immediate ascent, and soon I was left alone. There were tree stumps lurking along the trail, and from afar they looked like bears peeking out at you. The first one almost scared me to death. I wore a mask over my face, and it started to fall off. But instead of stopping to put another one on, I decided to keep going without it. On the trail, there's a point where you turn around and follow part of the course back. Runners were heading up, and as they passed me, each gave me a word of encouragement. There were no negative words or looks. I felt comfortable without the mask amongst them. I felt strengthened. Later on, I saw a group of hikers with their dogs. A husky blocked the trail with his body as if to say stop. Those people, they were yelling, "Hey bear, no bear." They told me that they had seen a bear across the valley and that maybe I should stick with them until the runner behind me caught up. But I wasn't sure if she was still back there. So I decided to proceed alone with caution. I just wanted to finish. Not too far down the trail, I saw him in the trees, a large black bear, most likely male. We looked at each other. I thought about the two that were mauled earlier that summer. I was so scared. Instinctively, I walked forward while yelling. I must have looked like a mad woman. When I didn't see him anymore, I started running. It started raining. I kept looking back and kept moving forward. Up ahead, I saw another black bear run across the trail into the overgrown plants. Bears everywhere, bear poop everywhere. Behind me, I heard the loudest scream. Was someone being attacked? It screamed again. It was a hawk. I prayed with all of my might and imagined the angels surrounding me. And I hoped that the hawk had scared the bear away. At mile 36, I remember thinking, you're almost there, you're badass, keep going. Mile 40, 48, I couldn't believe it. Then I thought, shouldn't have I finished by now? Did I miss a turn? Soon I heard voices, then I saw cars. I heard a man's voice say, there's Carol. I saw my sister jumping up and down. I had never cried so hard, yet so quietly before. But I finished. I have since completed several ultra marathons, and my next goal is to finish a 100-mile race. That 16-year-old girl sitting in the ambulance had no sense of what life really meant. But after experiencing that darkness, I realized how precious and fragile life is. And I'm very grateful to be here still and to be able to see and to be able to talk and to tell my story. The depression hasn't gone away. It's still there. There are days where I'm exhausted from everything that I've been through and go through. But I've learned how to keep going day by day and mile by mile.
Carol Sepulu received a standing ovation from the audience in Anchorage that night. 1,200 people literally jumped to their feet. I've said it 1,000 times, but Moth audiences are hands down the best. Carol works at a nursing home in Nome as a cultural activity specialist. She says her favorite part of the job is preparing native foods such as seal and reindeer, because seeing the elders enjoy the foods they grew up eating makes her happy. Carol runs about 40 miles a week, and she told me there's a 100-mile race that goes from Hope, Alaska to Cooper Landing and back again to Hope, and that is her goal race. You can find out more about Carol and her racing adventures on our website, themoth.org. That's it for this episode. We hope you'll join us again next time for the Moth Radio Hour.
Your host this hour was Meg Bowles. Meg also directed the stories in the show, along with Michelle Jalowski. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Emily Couch. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Willie Nelson, Daryl Anger and Bruce Molsky, The Peggy Lee Band, and Moondog. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, it's our annual Halloween Spooktacular, featuring all manner of music from monsters, munsters, mummies, and other people in show business. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour, Saturday night at 7 on KPR.
I think it's hands down the best Retro Cocktail Hour evening of the whole year, the Halloween Spooktacular on the Retro Cocktail Hour, this evening on Kansas Public Radio. We're your place for the Retro Cocktail Hour, This American Life, and NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, from the universes KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Coming up next here on KPR, it's This American Life. Today on This American Life, stories of people who tell a lie and then believe the lie more than anyone else. In other words, stories about people pulling hoaxes on themselves. That's just ahead here on KPR. Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble, featuring trios for horn, cello, and piano, 4 p.m. tomorrow at Lutheran Church of the Resurrection in Prairie Village. Details at midwestchamberensemble.org. Sunny skies today, highs in the mid-60s. It's 56 degrees in Lawrence. This is KPR.
Parents, here is all the evidence that you need that TV is bad for kids, especially public TV. When Sean was 14, he loved watching those British TV shows that are always running on PBS, Masterpiece Theater, Doctor Who.
And then there was this show that I would stay up really late and watch and tape and watch over and over again. The tapes called Dempsey and Makepeace, which was about an American detective who went to London because he had been like set up at home, and he was teamed up with a woman who was this aristocrat named Lady Harriet Makepeace, and I was really on her side. I thought, you know, she's got it going on.
You looked down on the American.
Oh yeah.
What Sean liked about Lady Harriet Makepeace and all the other Brits on TV was their aloofness, how they seemed above it all, how they looked down on Americans. Which Sean did also. Convinced there must be something wrong with the nation that produced jocks and bullies who harassed him in school. And sometimes, joking around with his friends, he would talk with a British accent.
And then it was just something that spiraled out of control. I know that eventually I was just using an English accent literally from waking to sleeping, morning, noon, and night.
Sean spoke with a British accent from the time he was 14 until he was 16. And at some point, his mom thought, you know, maybe I need to do something about this, and took him to see a psychiatrist.
He was just really, I don't know, you know, the different schools of psychology, but he was really very confrontive. And he was like, well, you know, you've got to stop doing this, he said, because you're not British, you know. And my mom just sort of sat over next to me, and she sort of went, yeah, to agree with him and, you know, to, you know, sort of help him in showing me this.
Sean was furious. He had an impulse to lecture the guy on how, in fact, he was British. And the only problem with that was that, A, he knew very well that he was not, and B, his mom was sitting right there. She was sure to contradict him. He didn't know what to do. The situation seemed impossible.
Because that's what I was thinking. Like, there has to be a way that I could be British still.
There must be a way that this is true somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
But today on our radio program, stories of people who tell a lie, and they get to the point where they believe the lie more than anybody else does. It feels like it must be true. Happens all the time. And can I say, we are not even going to get into what happens with political figures in this show, kidding themselves about the facts of things. Today we have stories of civilians, people like you and me, basically pulling hoaxes on ourselves. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. Tell your smart speaker to play KPR. The holiday season will be swinging with KPR's Big Band Christmas, Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall. The Kansas City Jazz Orchestra will be back on hand again to provide big band hits and Christmas favorites, too. Tickets are on sale now at the Liberty Hall box office and at Ticketmaster.com. KPR's Big Band Christmas is made possible in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka. Sunny skies this afternoon with highs in the mid-60s, light winds from the east. Sunny and warmer for tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s. This is KPR.
It's This American Life, Act 1, The Sun Never Sets in the Moosewood Restaurant. So this is the story of two young people who, for a period in their lives, in their search to figure out who they were, pretended to be people who they were not. We're going to hear from Sean Cole and from Joel Lovell. We're going to start with Sean. Today's show is a rerun. This was recorded years ago. These days, Sean is a producer here at our show. Sean grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, a town that was approximately 3,350 miles from London.
It was second nature. It was first nature. It was, you know, to this day, I have trouble saying, oh, I faked an accent for 2 years. I mean, I had an accent for 2 years.
Sean, could I just ask you to take a deep breath and describe for me what you had for lunch today, or perhaps for breakfast this morning, in as close to the accent that you can
as close as I can.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna take a sip of water here. Well, Ira, I had a salad. I had it at the Boston House of Pancakes, or pizza, rather.
What was the beverage?
It was a Snapple, a just lemon flavored. I don't really like the peach.
Joe Lovell's story began when he left the working-class town where he grew up, in upstate New York. His parents owned a liquor store in a small town. He was the first member of his family to go to college, and it was an especially big deal because he got into an Ivy League school, Cornell.
It was one of those first days of college, you know, when you spend a lot of time. Everybody kind of moves in hordes, and you spend a lot of time in each other's dorm rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about, 10 or 11 of us in this one guy's room. And we were just like sitting around eating pizza and talking, and people were talking about what their, where they were from and what their parents did and stuff like that. And there was one guy whose dad was a doctor for the Knicks. There was another guy whose father was an elected representative from New York State. And then this other guy whose father was on the world court. Literally was a member of the world court.
Oh, my.
And so it suddenly seemed like this incredibly sort of impressive group to me. And they seemed like just sort of worldly in ways that, you know, they were just beyond my wildest imagination. And you know, worldly beyond, you know, what I am now, frankly. and I remember sort of sitting there at the time thinking, oh, my God, I'm so out of my league here. And then completely unplanned, I suddenly said, as a slice of pizza was passed to me, this sort of pizza with sausage on top of it, I said, I can't take that because my parents are vegetarians. And everybody in the room kind of sort of turned and looked at me because it wasn't even as if I said, well, you know, I'm a vegetarian. But I said, you know, my parents are vegetarians. And there's a sort of puzzled look on everybody in the room. And I said, well, you know, and I am too. I've never eaten meat. And I'm not entirely, well, I mean, I have some ideas now about why I said that, but at the time I had no idea what I was saying. It was like, you know, suddenly I'd become possessed, and I had to think of something to say about myself that seemed interesting. And vegetarianism was the thing that I chose.
Now, did you tell people that you were actually from England?
No. No, never that I was from Britain, but in a way that I was British. You know, there was a real distinction there for me. Like, I, you know, I'd taken it on. Like, I was culturally British now.
Well, I think what it was is, I think I did some sort of calculus that took, like, a nanosecond in my head. And I thought, you know, I can't actually lie about what my parents do. But I think the connections that I was making were this, that somehow, like, because I was from this town in the sticks, if my folks were vegetarians, then the whole history that suggested was that they were sort of these, you know, these kind of leftist academic radicals who had sort of dropped out of society and gone back to the land. And I was living in this bumpkin town in upstate New York, and you know, my folks were living some sort of life that was driven by their political philosophy rather than, you know, I was just a guy who grew up in upstate New York.
You know, I did the old kid thing of, like, wishing that my real British parents would come and tell me I was adopted and take me back to London.
So I'm sitting there in the room, and all these guys are looking at me. And they're like, dude, you know, then, you know, what do you eat? And suddenly I realized in that moment how little I knew about vegetarianism. And I tried to be real sort of vague about it. You know, we eat salads and lentils. I remember sort of saying lentils a lot.
You know, and there was a gap. Certainly in my education, because, like, I would be using, you know, words that Americans just don't use. You know, I would, instead of saying drugstore, I would say chemist, or, you know, I would try my best to remember to say, you know, bonnet instead of hood or boot instead of trunk, but I often couldn't.
On the meal plan, I ended up eating a lot of big piles of iceberg lettuce and chickpeas.
And during that time, would you find yourself sneaking to go to get meat somewhere?
Yeah, definitely. At first, I would go really far from campus in order to have like a BLT. There was this there's this diner downtown in Ithaca, and it was, you know, it felt incredibly illicit. I'd be sitting there and I'd have some reading material or something with me, and I'd be the lonely guy in my booth. And I would order the BLT, and I would sort of watch it kind of coming from across the room, you know, with its toothpick in the top of it, and a side of French fries with this meat gravy on top, and it would just, you know, when it landed on the table, it would just seem like this incredibly, you know, sort of wonderful moment, you know, when you're doing something just totally unlike what anybody would expect of you.
I was nobody, you know. I mean, I was living in an extremely small kind of rural town in the middle of nowhere. It was, I guess, in a way, like, this was my way of traveling, you know, in a way, and of being somebody, and sort of achieving an identity, which I guess I didn't feel like I had. Like, I didn't feel like I am just sort of realizing this now, but I guess I didn't feel as though I had anything that made me up.
I mean, what I realized fairly quickly is that if this is going to be believable, I actually have to I have to believe in it. But I also began to not only believe, but really sort of take on as my persona all of the stuff that I imagined was associated with vegetarianism. So,
like, what?
Well, you know, certain political convictions and ways of dress.
I wore ripped jeans and I wore combat boots, but I also wore like a kind of stage jacket that you would see, you know, in a community theater production of Hamlet.
Yeah, you know, I bought sandals. I very specifically remember going down to this thrift store in downtown Ithaca and buying a pair of fatigue shorts, which just seemed like, you know, I might as well have been Che Guevara at that point. Sorry, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was a dangerous leftist.
Did you at any point during this find yourself in the following argument where you would say, I've never had a hamburger, and somebody would insist, oh, you must have had meat at some point, and then you had to argue your side?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't pretty. And of course, you know, I had grown up. I mean, just to put this in context for a second, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only had I had hundreds of hamburgers and gone to the McDonald's drive-thru hundreds of times, but the counterpoint situation that I always think about when I remember this time is that when I was a senior in high school, my family, for sort of time-saving reasons, decided that a great thing to do would be to go to Arby's Roast Beef. I don't know if you have those out in Chicago. I think they're countrywide. So my dad and I would go to Arby's on, say, like a Thursday afternoon or something, or after I got out of school. And we would go in there and we would buy 48 Arby's Roast Beef sandwiches. they would put them in this cardboard box. And we would bring home this giant box full of those tinfoil covered Arby's roast beef sandwiches, and we would stuff them in our freezer. We would freeze the Arby's roast beef sandwiches, and then we would have them there.
Buns
and all, yeah. And so we would have them there as ready-made snacks whenever we might want one. I mean, that's the kind of meat-eating that my family was engaged
The other thing was that I had these run-ins with doubting my British identity, like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, as though it were slipping away. And I would really go nuts at that point. And, you know, there was one time it would happen at home. I was, like, at home, and I was like, oh, my God, I have to do something. I have to affirm my devotion, you know. So I think I opened up the window, and I psyched myself to do it. I was like, oh, man, if I don't do this, like, it won't come back. And I opened up the window, and then I screamed. This is the middle of the night, or, you know, 10 at night. I screamed, I love England, like, outside the – and, of course, in a British accent, outside the window.
And then you felt better? You felt like you had reasserted yourself?
I felt like I had done something, at least.
For England?
Yeah, I had fortified my Britishness.
I would find myself in these conversations where people were saying, you know, you've never had a McDonald's hamburger? What kind of American, 18-year-old American, has never had a hamburger from McDonald's?
Quite a legitimate question, I would add.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would say, yeah, you know, I've just never had one. They scare me. And I would sort of, like, talk about the ways, you know, and I would make up these stories about how I'd come close a couple of times, how a friend of mine in high school had bought me a Big Mac, and there I was sitting on the front seat of his car, and I almost ate it and then couldn't bring myself to do it. And so, yeah, there was all the sort of drama that I lied about. My mom and dad came down to visit for Parents Weekend, and they were really proud that I was going there and really excited to come down. And they came down to visit.
And really proud because you were the first generation to go to college. You made it into this Ivy League school. It was a big, big deal.
Right, exactly, exactly. And so they drove down from Camillus, which is about, you know, between an hour and an hour and a half, they came down. And, you know, in that week leading up to Parents Weekend, everybody's talking about their parents coming, and everybody's making reservations at restaurants, you know, where to eat on Saturday night, and everybody's sort of planning on taking their parents to the football game on, you know, Saturday during the day. And it suddenly occurred to me, this real sort of panic set in, that, you know, that my parents would come down, and we would go to a football game, and my dad would buy a hot dog, and, you know, and somebody, like, across the field would see Mr. Lovell eating a hot dog. And, you know, and then, of course, the cat would be out of the bag. And so I thought, you know, I've got to make a reservation at a restaurant at some place, either A, where nobody else's parents will be, or at a vegetarian restaurant. And so what I did was make a reservation at the Moosewood restaurant, which is in Ithaca. And, you know, there's the Moosewood cookbooks that are out and
vegetarian cookbooks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's this nice little vegetarian restaurant in Ithaca and a slightly famous place. But then we got there and, you know, and it just, I remember sitting down at the table in the Moosewood and,
and you know, the bowls are these kind of carved wooden bowls, and I mean, everything about it feels like, well, like a vegetarian restaurant.
And not just a vegetarian restaurant, but kind of a cartoon of a vegetarian restaurant.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and I was looking at my parents across the table, and they were sort of dressed up, and they were excited to be coming down. And, you know, and I could tell, like, my dad was sitting there and sort of perusing the menu and thinking, well, you know, I'll, you know, maybe this lentil salad will be good or whatever. And I could tell he was sitting there thinking, you know, geez, I just drove an hour and a half. All I want is a steak and a baked potato and a beer, you know? And there I was bringing them here. But they were so game about it. They were sort of willing to go along with it because for some reason they thought I really wanted to bring them there. And I just thought, geez, you know, these people, my parents, you know, have really like given up a lot for me to come there. I mean, financially, they were really stretching themselves, and we were taking out all sorts of loans, you know, all of those things that people do in order to go to college.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they never complained once about doing it. And they, you know, they just wanted to come down and see me there and feel proud that I was there. And I was sort of hiding them out in this vegetarian restaurant. And I felt so bad about it afterwards. And they never